You're listening to an OTB AM podcast. You can watch the show or listen live every weekday morning from 7:45 AM. Subscribe to the OTB AM podcast stream for more stuff just like this. Very good morning to you. Welcome along this Monday morning, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. Looking forward to a week of hot and heavy analysis of the rugby team and what the hell the future holds for Maurizio Sarri and Chelsea. It was an amazing weekend of sport. We promised you something good, and there was plenty to get our teeth stuck into, including a bit of Congress, some racing if we have time, and the Dubs, they're back. They were never really gone at all. It turns out they're absolutely brilliant. But Kerry have won four in a row, and so... You know, people, I see our erstwhile colleague, Oisin Langan, calling it that Kerry are going to win SAM this year. So lots for you to get your teeth stuck into, including a brilliant competition courtesy of Dove. We're going to give you that in a couple of minutes' time, the opportunity to shadow the Irish kitman. I'll tell you how you can do that. In the meantime, Johnny Ward, good morning to you.
Good morning, Ger. I think you bigged up the weekend a bit there. It was a little bit disappointing, was it not?
Ah, no.
The Man United game was crap.
Yeah, but you're never going to forget the Maurizio Sarri... Kepa incident. It's like an all-time moment in world football history where somebody teaches everybody the rules.
Isn't that what it was? I'd never seen this before. 36 years, 30 years maybe watching soccer, never seen that before.
Very quickly, Twitter finds that you don't have to go off when you can refuse to go off. This is going to change the game. Imagine this now. Imagine every...
Yeah, not sure about that now. I think
every egotistical...
Yeah. And there are a lot of...
Underperforming striker in the world is like, nah, I'm staying on. Kepa can do it, I'm doing it.
Yeah, if Mourinho tried to take Pogba off and Pogba was aware of these rules, you could easily see him just, nah, not coming off.
I'm saying, have a listen to this. So for anybody who doesn't know what we're talking about, yesterday...
He's determined, it's a war of wills at the moment between the goalkeeper and his manager, but you know who the boss is. And it's the boss's word that counts, he's got to go off here.
That's not a great sign when you are... trying to ignore your manager, not what you want to see. Shows a lack of authority really from the boss, but certainly it betrays the lack of respect from the players, or at least one player. He can't back down, he's got to force him to come up. He's made his decision, he's got to stand his ground. Sorry, can't let the player win in this situation.
Yeah, when he does,
looks like he has though.
Oh, it's almost like a... Who's in control of this club? Who's in control of this team?
The lunatic's taken over the asylum. It's one of those.
Players.
No. Well, the players won. It's incredible. Absolutely incredible.
There's about another 4 minutes for this. Is there? Yeah, there's about...
If that doesn't undermine you, I don't know what does. And Sarri is absolutely incandescent and with every right to be. Well, he's walking away. He might be walking away from the stadium. Is he walking away from the job?
I mean, it's brilliant commentary, in fairness.
They did a nice job on the commentary, yeah. They really built it up for what it was. I've offered real sympathy for Sarri. Like, it's a public humiliation at the last time that he needed it. And Chelsea played well yesterday. I know it was a Carabao Cup final, but they played well. They looked like they were playing for their manager. Defensively, they restricted Man City to very few chances. And then you have this nonsense, you know.
By the team, against the team who humiliated them 6-0 just 2 weeks ago, which was like the kind of final nail
in the coffin, yeah.
It really felt that way. But they spent 80 million on Kepa in the summer. And, you know, you're like, well, this is going to be a foundational piece for our future.
Yeah. And in all normal circumstances, now he should be gone out of the club like as soon as possible.
What can you do? You can't. You've got to keep him. And John Terry was on COCOM, who everybody assumes is like Chelsea manager in waiting at some point, and maybe part of. So the word about Zidane is starting to firm up so much that you feel like somebody has already leaked something. And I don't know if they're going to shoehorn, crowbar John Terry in to be the one who pats. Checks Zidane's back for the best part of the knife, you know, just ribs 3 and 4. Silent, you don't even have to breathe. No one can hear you scream, Zinedine, don't worry about it. But he was there like, oh, that keeper, he's not that type of lad. He really isn't. As I think it was Gavin Cooney pointed out on Twitter.
What type of lad, though? I mean...
All the guile of somebody who feels that he might be working with Kepa in a couple of months'
time.
Definitely.
Because he didn't exactly go to town on him, did he?
And it's like, it's despicable behaviour.
I think it is.
And, Sarri comes out afterwards and says he had cramp and he recovered and it was a misunderstanding and the medical staff hadn't told us that he'd recovered.
Yeah, but they had to give a PR front because Sarri's trying to redeem himself. He's trying to keep himself in the job and... you know, the comments afterwards were really rubbish when you think about it. It was quite obvious that he refused to come off. And it doesn't matter if he were injured or not injured. The manager asked him to come off and he wouldn't. And you could see from their body languages, like, Sarri, he was very Italian in terms of his temperament going down the tunnel and then kind of realising, oh, what am I doing here? I think he just lost the plot a little bit.
Yeah.
But
then he comes back, right? And there's another bit which we didn't play there where, so the game finishes before the penalty shootout and they're all standing around and Sarri's about as far away from Kepa as I am from you, but Kepa has his back to him and Rudiger comes over and pushes the manager away. Like he was an angry, like you would have seen one of Paolo Di Canio's teammates back in the day pushing him away from whatever the latest thing that he was really upset about.
Yeah, the referee or whatever.
And you're like, I mean, at that point, it's totally gone.
Yeah.
He just has no authority anymore.
Sola didn't look very convincing either, did he, when he was trying
to
plead?
No, like, come on. Yeah. Come on.
Yeah. It was hard to see from at a human level, it was hard to see for Sarri, because I'd say Sarri's a decent man. He's very honest in interviews, which I like. It's already been, I suppose, wrote into the narrative that he's not able to change his ways, which I'm not sure about. I mean, yesterday they looked quite tactically astute yesterday and they gave a very good account of themselves.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, the narrative is there that he's lost the dressing room. And when that happens, you're probably on borrowed time, aren't you?
He feels like he's one of those Chelsea managers who actually could be good at another Premier League club as opposed to one of those Chelsea managers who just got the job because he was trendy for a few weeks.
Well, it's strange because when he got the job, so many players were hailing his role and just particularly Ross Barkley just saying how much he changed his career and training was so different to anything they'd experienced before. And it's not like they're having a bad season, really. I don't think they really have the talent to be any better than the top four team anyway. They're definitely not good enough to win the league with that team. They need a striker or two, and they need to hold on to Hazard, which is not going to happen, I would say.
Yeah. All right, there's loads of other things that we should be talking about, including Ireland's performance against Italy, where we got a bonus point away win, has been compared to the 2007 Rugby World Cup, where we were really the most outclassed and embarrassed that we've been at any of the Rugby World Cups. So is this in keeping with where we actually are at the moment, or is this again part of that overreaction to the England game? It's hard to tell. We're going to get the expert opinion of Alan Quinlan in about 5 minutes' time, and then we'll speak to Ronan O'Gara in about an hour as well. So, here we go. As Ireland prepare for their penultimate Guinness Six Nations clash against France at the Aviva, the official partner, Dove Men and Care, is giving you the chance to be part of the captain's run. The winner will join the IRFU kit man, John Moran, as he prepares the dressing room for the Irish rugby team ahead of their final training session before the big game. And as if that isn't enough, the winner will also receive a pair of tickets to see Ireland against France at the Aviva the following day. To be in with the chance to win, just tell us what your favourite rugby jersey is. You can tweet us or comment while you're watching the show. Make sure you use the hashtag TeamCare and the hashtag OTBAM so that we know that you have entered. So give us a picture of your favourite jersey. This is one here. So this is France 1995, is it? That's class.
That's a lovely jersey as well.
The World Cup in 1995. That kind of looks better on the human being as opposed to the mannequin. England, I mean, who's nominating England jerseys? Who is nominating England jerseys? I don't like that England jersey, actually. There are some cool, I know you're not allowed to say it, but there are some cool England jerseys down there. That's from England 04. We win that game, so that's all right.
That's a nice jersey, no?
Scotland 04, famous grouse.
It's great. The Scottish kit's a great colour as well.
Yeah, you can do a lot with it.
Yeah.
And, you know, the trim is kind of nice as well. The white collar, that's pretty good. So, and then this is Ireland from 09.
Nah. Yeah, I wouldn't be mad on the design there now. Prince William looking very happy in the background.
It's a rugby pitch, isn't it? Is it? And Mary McAleese. Mary McAleese had a good out innings.
She did.
Saw a lot of big victories.
She did. We saw Scotland there. You think Scotland aren't...
Scotland are a rabble.
A rabble.
Ah, France. France, it wasn't even close, really. Even though, France completely lacking confidence, devoid of everything, still managed to turn in a French-style performance from the 1990s, where it was like, oh, look, we can run from inside our own half.
We need a favour off Scotland now, do we, to have a chance to win this tournament?
We can just beat Wales. If we beat Wales...
How does it work, though? With our points situation, if England win the rest of their games... and we win. So if ourselves, Wales and England end up with one defeat and four wins,
then it comes down to bonus points, and England got a bonus point against us.
Yeah.
And we, and they've got one against Italy. So you would assume that England's bonus points will carry them to victory.
Yeah. So basically we're probably screwed.
But if they drop a bonus point, we'll do them by points difference? Maybe. We need to put up a lot of points. Yeah, we need to put up a lot of points against. Here's what's coming up. So Alan Quinlan's outside. We get him in now. Sports pages, 10 past 8. Daniel Harris going to talk to us about the Liverpool-Man United game, which obviously was a bit of a damn squib. The sports news with Darren and then Ronan O'Gara on Ireland. So yesterday on Virgin Media, Shane Horgan did compare Ireland's Six Nations run to his side's ill-fated 2007 World Cup campaign.
I am a little bit worried, and I'll tell you why, because it just had a feeling for me around a similar feeling I experienced myself in the 2011 World Cup.
Sorry,
2007 yeah. World Cup. I've just erased it from my mind entirely. 2007 World Cup, where, you know, things were going brilliantly, and in that Six Nations before that World Cup, you know, everything was great. We probably should have won the championship, lost it on the last day, the points difference. You know, put a massive score up against Italy, and everything was seen to be fine, and then a couple of things went wrong, and we just couldn't write it again. We just couldn't get it right. And I'm not saying that this group of players are in the same situation, but it's just a sense of that. And I thought today was the big opportunity to, you know, get things right again and get very positive. And you can see by the body language, by the way Sexton, you know, was, you know, shouting and screaming when he was coming off. By the way, even when they scored the Bowman's try, there was no celebration. Mm. In Sean Cronin's performance, in fact, Bundyaki went off and nobody got the midfield going then afterwards. In so many areas, you just thought they didn't get things right.
Yeah, we didn't get things right in so many areas. That's Shane Horgan, Alan Quinlan. Good morning to you. You're welcome back.
Good morning. Yeah, thanks, Ger.
Nice little whistle stop tour of the most romantic spots in Europe.
It was a quick
you
hit.
You and Dave McIntyre.
Paris, Friday night.
Twin room.
Rome, Saturday night. And Dave McIntyre not talking to me, really, just doing his own thing.
Just right. Kinda, just ignored you.
A little bit, yeah. He kind of mooches off really quickly and through the airports, and I'm looking around, where are you? And he's trying to be one step ahead of everybody else and getting cues and stuff like that, and I'm looking around for him.
Yeah.
So he's not really babysitting me like I like, you know.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about this. Are we overreacting, or is this absolute full-blown crisis time?
It's not full-blown crisis, I don't think. It's frustrating more. It's obviously frustrating for people watching, and we're going to analyse it and kind of pick it apart and stuff, but on the outside. But for the players themselves, they're frustrated. I think Joe Schmidt makes a very relevant point that they are trying too hard. Given what happened against England, and you know, this team were on an unbelievable flow and an unbelievable run for the last 18 months. A couple of years, you could say, they found a way to win, and there was a lot of positives. And, you know, if they had a blip, they bounced back pretty quickly, creating a lot of chances and opportunities, and really, really good in their detail. So they've hit a wall where England, it's relevant to go back to that English game because it's like the positivity and the
confidence.
The feel-good factor going into that was, we beat England, they're going to be tough, very good English side, but we get through that and it kicks off our campaign. Historically, we've been a bit slow out of the blocks for some reason, and that has kind of dented our confidence a little bit. Then Scotland, I thought Scotland's a good win because we're kind of expecting perfection, and really, they were never going to lose that game. The disappointment in the end was not getting the bonus point win. And there was a feeling then that this one, and I even thought this, right, here's your chance to build a bit of confidence, get a good score, blood some more players, and then build for that last block. And they've kind of, you know, uncharacteristic errors was the concern for me yesterday. I think it was 17 turnovers conceded, 15 handling errors. So it's just that the handling errors, there was a couple of them there where you go, well, that's a mental thing. It's not a skill set. I know one or two passes were poor and there's a little bit of timing and overrunning passes, but some of the handling errors were really poor. The four lost lineouts out of 20. It doesn't seem a lot when you have 20 lineouts and lose four, but like two lineouts can change the complexion of a game,
yeah.
Particularly if you're in an attacking area.
They got a try off one of our lineouts.
Yeah. And if you're in turn, if you're in a defensive area where you've got to win it and you clear it, sometimes people don't see the value and how important that line-out was to take away the momentum and confidence of the opposition, where you're really efficient, you win it, clear your lines, and you're hurting them, putting them down the field. Some of the kicks were really poor, not from Murray and Sexton, from other players, where we kick the ball up the middle of the field or we don't find touch. And Jaden Hayward, their full-back, he's a lovely counter-attacker and he's running straight back. And I always think, if you're a forward there, I think Sean O'Brien turned one over at one stage when Italy were, after about 20, 25 minutes, Italy have us under pressure. He strips the ball brilliantly in the tackle, turns it over. I think we kicked the ball away. We got it back again where Sexton intercepted it. And then we kicked the ball straight down the field and Hayward is back again. You know, they're kind of moments that, they're crucial moments that some people maybe mightn't see any value in. But you got to put those ones out in the stand. Then as a forward, you're running down the field with the Italian guys around you and you feel the energy, you feel the lift from that. So defence can win you games and then tactical play. So tactically we made mistakes. And going back to what Joe said about them trying too hard, I just thought a lot of the time yesterday they were just shipping the ball on. And then they'd make a little bit of ground and then someone would get kind of driven back by a two-man tackle. And then we're trying to recycle and run around and realign. The Italians are coming around the corner and they're sprinting off the line again. It's very hard to play that. So I just thought at times we needed to probably tighten it up a little bit and pick and jam around the rocks and stuff like that. And so our team's figuring us out a little bit. Well, Conor O'Shea got a strategy. And every team has this strategy. Stop the opposition defensively. Get loads of numbers in their faces. But it's just what you do before that with the ball and stuff. And you know, there's just too many times it wasn't good enough.
There's part of you feels like you'd like to see what would have happened if they'd managed to catch the restart that drifts over one of their lads' heads that Stockdale scores a try from.
Stockdale scores, yeah.
Like, you know, we're not going to score one of those tries every week. It wasn't through sheer creativity and brilliance that we scored the try that wins the game.
To be fair, the Quinn Roo try was pressure, momentum, hard lines, some great carries.
So do it again.
And
keep doing it. And
the Earl's try in the second half was the same. At other times, we just gave the ball away. We'd no real sustained pressure. And at times, we were going over and back. So it's a bit of a blip, for sure. And some of the accuracy was really bad. And it is a concern, but I wouldn't overly react the same way. Look, it's they're in a kind of a tough place at the moment. And Wales made 10 changes for their game in Italy and they struggled as well. They won by 10 points as well. And
that's a fair point,
you know,
as well.
They go then and beat England, do you know what I mean? There's about 10 guys. Like, I was trying to go through the players. Best, Healy, Ryan, Toner. That's four players in the front five.
Yeah.
You could say Tadhg Bourne and Liam Henderson are two players who could start as well. So that's about six players in that front five. Then you've Stander, your first choice number eight, is missing. Then your second choice number eight, Conan, is missing. You know, there's about six, seven forwards there that could easily start. And you think, yeah, they can change things up. They're big game players. And then you look at the back line where, you know, you've Henshaw, Ringrose, Larmour, Carberry, which he gives you something different. You know, he gives you that option off the bench as well. Aki going off early. You know, so there's a lot of players that have come out there. So is it a good thing at the moment?
Well, you don't want this happening in the middle of the World Cup, right?
Well, you'd love to have gone to Rome at the weekend and had a great performance. I was saying, what's a good result? And I was chatting to Dave about it beforehand. A good result is 20-25 point win for me, and not conceding sloppy tries and being a bit ruthless. Our maul was really poor, and the refereeing around the maul at the moment is just catastrophic, in my opinion. Not just for Ireland, for everyone. It's
in
happening
that players European are around the wrong side.
The guys are coming around the side, right, and the maul is twisting and turning, and then they're just staying there.
Yeah.
They're kind of.
And the referees actually tell them. You know,
they're not telling them get out, they're just leaving them.
Are they telling them to stay binding?
If you stay bound, you know,
you're, okay
yeah,
on
you're
wrong
kind
side.
Of okay, and it's disinterpreted. It's shambolic at the moment. And when I played, the maul was always seen as a brilliant weapon. Very hard. I remember the great Leicester team that beat us in 2002 Heineken Cup final. They, Johnson, back, Lewis Moody, Ben Kay, Rountree, Cockerell, all these guys. They were mauling teams off the park. And I remember that final, we tried to stop that maul. We did do that really well and we were very proud of that, but they got two other tries and they beat us 15-9. But it's gone. The art of the maul is gone and it's not been refereed properly, and it needs to be some clarity around that. And Ireland are getting no go forward from their maul, really.
Because that was a big thing for us, that we felt that our maul was better than everybody else's.
Right, okay. Am I making excuses and saying, well, other teams can cope, New Zealand can, and England have coped, and Wales didn't need to maul England all over the place. But there's certain times that you need to work your maul really well. And Joe Schmidt made a point last week as well that maybe Ireland are too disciplined and they're too nice at times. And they're allowing teams to frustrate them now, and that teams have worked out, look, get in Ireland's faces here, niggle them, be awkward. Like, there was a load of mauls yesterday that kind of split off, and there's two or three Italian players holding O'Mahony, holding Deland. They're actually stopping them from reconnecting with the maul for 2-3 seconds, and it has an effect. And then you end up with a maul of 3 or 4 guys against 3 or 4 as opposed to 8 against 5 or 8 against 6.
And the whole team doesn't benefit.
Yeah, so look, that's just one kind of point that's annoying me in the modern game of rugby as it stands. But
the Italians afterwards, their first question in the press conference was reportedly to Conor Murray, Conor, we were playing against 16 men out there today, because they felt like they got completely ridden by the referee. And, you know, there's a case that Rob Kearney should have been penalised and yellow carded. There's a case that Rob Kearney was actually totally fine with the tackle when the ball gets chipped through that time.
That was unlucky though, wasn't it? Like, it was so, you're talking about a split second, couldn't get out of the way.
It's a bump. Look, we'd probably look for it and say, but I tell you,
if that happened against us, we'd be up
for their second try. Your man
pushes Earls.
Adavani. He just pushes Earls clean onto the ground.
Yeah.
Right, Earls gets back up and ends up going back and being involved in the tackle area. But if Earls is on his feet there, there's every chance that he affects it and negates that attack. It's a clear penalty.
I wonder, though, does that not get given? Because he's clearly running a lazy line at that point.
Yeah, but like, he's entitled to run back. He's not blocking anyone off and he's trying to retreat to get back and help. But look,
it did feel a bit like, Asher, it's only Italy.
Yeah.
We'll let them away.
Let it flow.
Yeah.
Look, I'd heard that question about Glenn Jackson and I saw some stuff online about it from some people. Italy's discipline was poor. They should have been penalised way more in the maul. So a couple of decisions probably went their way, but I didn't see it. And I genuinely tried to watch it, even though I want Ireland to win, as neutral as I can. I didn't see any major decisions that he gave against Italy that would have affected it. Their discipline was really poor at times. And
you do have to wonder, if you're Conor Shea, when you have a kicker who is as flaky as the kicker that they have, they also have a fullback who is traditionally a kicker. Why not let that guy kick?
Yeah, from Tommaso Allan, yeah, the couple of the conversions he missed. And
penalty as well.
Yeah, penalty as well. So it was a long-range penalty, to be fair. I was surprised they were kicking that one because the wind was kind of swirling in the stadium a little bit. But to be fair, I had a good chat with Sergio Parisa before the game, and I've had these chats with him before and he's been optimistic. But I felt yesterday that there was a genuine kind of positivity about the way they're going. They have a guy, Paul Atchison, with Italy now, who's head of athletic performance. And they're kind of trying to implement a similar system here where they have control of the national players between Zebra and Benetton, which they have, because they're funded by the national union. And that their fitness levels and their skill sets
are improving.
And he spends a lot of time with those. And they're getting to a level where they're trying to have a real good structure there.
Good enough to be able to be sticky for Ireland, an Ireland team short of some of its best players?
Of course be sticky, but if you, I don't know, Shane Horgan said in Virgin that, or Peter Romani said afterwards, a very good Italian team and they're a very good side. I don't think they are. I think we should be a lot better than that, and I agree with Shane Horgan that I played against Italian sides that were a lot more aggressive and robust, and, you know, Dominguez at out half, Troncon at scrum half.
Does it have
Parise, Bartolami, Perugini, Ongaro, Lechichero, the loose head, you know, hard, abrasive. Now, they're probably more skillful this side, but I don't think they'd hurt you physically as much.
That conversation led on to the reminiscing, if that's the right word, of 2007 and that World Cup. Is there the bang of 2007 off this team yet for you?
Uh, No.
I mean, that team is great. Look at that picture. That team was a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant
it
team.
It was, yeah.
And what I'm the hell happened?
Sitting in the stand at the World Cup, giving out that I wasn't going to be involved. Well, to be fair, it was well documented. That team was split. We went to Argentina. 30 of us was 15, 16 guys left at home.
And this team is less split, because I think that there's a chance that everybody who got a game yesterday feels like they have a chance, right?
Yeah, and I think, look, we've developed so much depth now in the group, but I think what some of the players probably have to realise now, particularly after the last two matches, is there's a higher level of performance required. Like, we beat Italy 57-14 in November with a completely second-string team. Now, I know they had probably, you know, a few of their frontliners missing, but they were definitely they had more of a first team than Ireland had. Six Nations is different. It's just a competitive edge to it. There's more urgency about it. There's more desire, passion about it. And look, I've been to Italy many times with good Irish sides who've struggled.
Yeah.
And we're happy to get a 10-point win, a 5-point win, a 9-point win. But I just think the standard of this team is set for themselves, and the expectation that's following them around a little bit now. And naturally, I think, like the hysteria over the English game, I wouldn't be that concerned. I think what we do have now is we've got to find ways of coping with pressure, on-field pressure, better if we're not as dominant as we usually have been. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So a lot of our success last year was on the back of brilliant line-out, brilliant scrum, efficiency at the breakdown, really good ball carries, good presentation for Murray. So you take away two or three of those, dodgy line-out yesterday, being stopped on the gain line, slow breakdown, what do we do? So we actually haven't... These situations now hopefully will stand the team in good stead. Jerry, they haven't become bad players overnight. I think there's been a fair bit of disruption, so they didn't play well enough. The big concern for me yesterday is the turnover, the turnovers conceded and the handling errors.
Yeah.
That's down to
fixable.
The top couple of inches.
Oh, that's all
but
fixable.
It's upstairs. So I think it's key what Joe Schmidt, the kind of strategy and the way he deals with this now. And look, I would trust him to get this right.
They've got it right before. We're running a competition this morning. The prize is a brilliant prize for the last training session before the France game. You get to go in and shadow the kitman, but we're asking people for their favourite jersey ever, favourite rugby jersey ever.
Yeah.
Do you have one?
I like one to wear, the big baggy ones from when I started out.
They were a fashion item back in the
but
day.
I swapped my French jersey in my first start in Dublin in the Six Nations. It was my second cap in 2001. I swapped that for the French jersey, but you get two jerseys, so I swapped the second one.
Right.
And I just loved that French
jersey.
That's
the Ireland one there, is it?
Yeah, they were the old baggy ones. Yeah, they're fairly stretchy.
Look at how scrawny O'Gara is.
And O'Driscoll.
But then when they went for the tight fitted jerseys, which were probably around 2002, 2003, that's the French jersey I would have swapped with. It was short sleeve, it was cool. Yeah. I still have it, the white collars.
You wear it out sometimes?
No, I do not. No, they're all kind of locked away. I'm keeping it for the young lad.
Just on the Cammy situation last night, he got five yesterday. Where are we at full back?
Well, he was the saviour in Scotland, and
I think that five's a bit harsh.
It is a bit harsh, yeah. I think it is a bit harsh. He dropped one ball that was kind of uncontested, which it kind of sums it up. It was just kind of here's another mistake, here's another mistake, here's guys who don't usually make these errors. So
was it a day just when for
yeah
no
it just
reason,
all those figure? Mistakes kind of started to translate around into the group, and they were all panicked. And I think what they were leadership is saying a team lacked leadership is kind of insulting in some ways, but when good leadership is players taking control on the field, having a little huddle saying, look, just put the ball down the field or do this, or this, and someone kind of throwing the toys out of the pram and rattling players in any level of sport. And we probably didn't see enough of that energy yesterday. Yeah. People were looking around saying, well, Jesus, who's going to do something brilliantly here? And there was probably three players that I could find who were full of energy and full of commitment, and that was Earls, O'Mahony and Ulton Delan. I thought Ulton Delan was brilliant. He's the kind of fella that, you know, just, he's non-stop. He put in 20 tackles and they were all
impressive.
Good tackles.
Yeah.
They were really kind of, and two of the tackles led to turnovers for Peter O'Mahony. So there's a lot of other guys who were just dead in their feet, which is unfortunate and strange.
Plenty of time to fix it though before the World Cup, so we're still going to win it. Don't worry about it. Quinny, good stuff. Thanks very much.
Sure.
We'll get back to this in about 25 minutes time with Ronan O'Gara. In the meantime, we're turning our attention to the football and the nil-all draw. We'll start with that anyway. Daniel Harris is with us this morning. Daniel, what did you make of Manchester United's performance yesterday, given the injuries that they had and the fact that they had to use their three subs in the first half?
Yeah, they played pretty well in the circumstances. It's interesting under Solskjaer, because what people tend to talk about is the way he's liberated the attackers and the better football that they're playing. But just as significant is the way that they're defending now. And the defence that Mourinho thought was appalling is actually turning out to be not that bad after all. I think they're 7 from 11 clean sheets. 7 in 11. Yeah, 7 in the last 11 they've kept clean sheets. So you don't do that by mistake. And they certainly haven't done it simply by packing the back four or sitting very deep. They had to do that a bit yesterday. But it wasn't a panicky clean. It wasn't a panicky clean sheet in the way that it was against Tottenham, where De Gea was made to make a whole load of saves. They actually looked very solid in defence, and you didn't really expect them to let anything in. So that is a big improvement under Solskjaer, and just as significant as their ability to attack properly. In fact, the way that they can defend is allowing them to attack properly.
That was the very interesting thing about Jesse, I thought, Gerard, was that if Solskjaer was advertising his credentials for the job, I think yesterday could have been a defining moment, because they really looked like a team who knew what to do when they were under the cosh. And Liverpool had so few chances in the game, Daniel. I thought if you're looking at some of Solskjaer's tactical kind of victories, maybe this was definitely up there, I thought, because they obviously didn't have much of the ball, but they really, of all the teams, all the games Liverpool have played this season, in terms of chances in a game, that must be one of the games where they created next to nothing.
Yeah, I mean, talking about Solskjaer, it's really hard to see him not getting the job now. I think, obviously, there's quite a lot that can happen between now and then, but it would require a collapse, because he's proved himself able to motivate the players and just make everyone feel happy and make the club feel like a happy place again. That by itself wouldn't be enough. That would be a handy job done by a caretaker. But the tactical acumen that he's shown to vary things according to opponents, to get by better opponents like they did against Tottenham, even against PSG. They got done in the second half against PSG, but that was only once Martial and Lingard had gone off. Against Burnley at home, he got his team wrong, but he managed to find a way to get a draw. And yesterday was the only other league game he hasn't won. And again, he managed to turn a point into coming out of that game with a lot of positives. So it's not just the being nice that people thought about him, but it's about finding its edge again and finding a way to get results in adverse circumstances. And that is a very key element of any manager. So they could collapse from here and end up finishing sixth. And if they do that, he won't get the job. But if they keep going the way that they're going, and there's not any particular reason to suggest that they won't, then he's got a really good chance of getting the job. And actually, it'd be hard to see him not getting the job.
Talk to us a little bit about what you made of Liverpool's performance yesterday, because when you consider the Manchester United team that was named and then the injuries that they suffer in the first half, they will be thinking that this was an opportunity lost.
It was absolutely an opportunity lost. I mean, the difficulty is that the teams at the top of the Premier League, and this isn't necessarily a reflection of their quality relative to all the teams that we've seen in the Premier League era, but relative to how the Premier League culture has changed. And it was Mourinho that changed that culture in 2005. Fergie always used to have this catchphrase, "Oh, we don't get going properly till after Christmas," as though taking the first half of the season off was some kind of lovable quirk. But Mourinho changed all of that. And now, if you want to win the Premier League, you pretty much have to win from the beginning of the season to the end of the season with very few slips. And because of that, it means that when teams drop points, when they're competing for the title, when there's actually a title race, and we haven't had that for the last 3 years, really, but when there is a title race, if you drop points, it is a very big deal. And not only did Liverpool drop points, but they drop points in a game that it was presented to them as an opportunity. Man United away is a difficult game, but Man United away with half a team, it's almost like that's a mid-table team with Pogba and De Gea almost were playing yesterday. And they were unable to make any kind of impression. So just dropping points itself is bad for them. But dropping points in that circumstance is not going to make them feel good about themselves at a time when Liverpool really look like they need to feel good about themselves, because they look very tight against Leicester in a game in which they took the lead. They looked even tighter against West Ham, another game where they were gifted the lead by an error by the linesman, and they were unable to make either of those games count. And it's kind of strange because that game they played against Manchester City at the turn of the year, where if Liverpool had won that game, it would have been very close to over. they absolutely did not bottle that game. They turned up in that day. In different circumstances, things would have gone differently and they could have even won that game. As it turned out, they lost to a better team. It happens. But it wasn't something that you thought would be fatal for their title hopes. But since then, they've barely turned up at all. I think they've won 3 out of 11 games in 2019. That's not title winning form. And I think what we're seeing is that they're regressing to the mean. They are a team with a good goalkeeper, a really good centre-back and a good forward line and some competence elsewhere. I guess their full-backs are quite good. But when you look at the names on that team, forget about how they play for a second. It's not intimidating. And when you look at the way they played last season, I actually feel like it was much more intimidating for opponents because you knew that if you had a bad day, Liverpool would tear you up in attack. But this season, they've changed the balance of the team. And I think the teams that are playing them are a lot less terrified by that. They might lose 1-0, but there's a lot less chance they're going to lose 5-2. And I think that they've sort of regressed to the mean of where they are relative to their ability, which is they're a good side, but they're not as good. They're not in the same postcode as Manchester City when Manchester City are playing well.
And yet they're a point ahead of them with 27 games gone in the season. So that's the bit then. Does that make Klopp an absolute genius to be able to go toe-to-toe over the course of the first 27 games of the season and be ahead of this Man City team?
I wouldn't say that makes Klopp a genius. Klopp's a great manager. What Klopp has is very similar to what Bill Shankly had, is the ability to make everyone come together, feel like they're part of something, get everyone on side. Of course, he also understands how football works. The thing about Manchester City is, no one could have predicted necessarily that things would get too easy for City. But that's how it looks. City have been beat this season by Newcastle from ahead, by Crystal Palace at home from ahead. Someone else beat them from ahead over Christmas, Leicester. They lost Leicester from 1-0 up as well. And a lot of times I've watched City play this season, also against Chelsea where they got beaten, and felt like City think that they just need to turn up to win this game. And so they've dropped points where you wouldn't necessarily expect them to drop points. The point that I made about Liverpool not being in the same postcode as Manchester City isn't necessarily over the course of the season. It's when City play at their best. They're the best team in this country by a long, long way. They just haven't done that this season. They haven't managed to produce the same level of consistency, and they've had a lot of injuries that they didn't have last season where everything seemed to go in their favour. So I think Klopp has done an exceptional job in the first half of the season to extract that many points from a team who, by the look of them, don't look like they should have that many points. I don't think that he's going to be able to do it in the second half of the season. It hasn't really looked like that. And it's not really looking like that. And it wouldn't be that surprising if they didn't beat Watford in midweek either, because Watford are playing well. Watford are a difficult team to play against. They're a team whose manager has them knowing exactly what they're doing. And Liverpool came out of a game that looked like it was made almost for them to find the confidence that they looked to have been missing this last month or so. And they couldn't do it. And they will start to feel it slipping away if they're not able to go on a winning run from now. And once it goes fast.
What's the latest with Firmino, do you know, Dan? Because Salah was taken off yesterday. He scored one goal against top six teams this season. That was against Arsenal at home in a game, which Arsenal were absolutely pathetic. And then Firmino, obviously, I think he was in crutches after the game. So I would be seriously worried for Liverpool if he gets injured for any sustained period of time.
Yeah, I agree. Firmino is one of those players who's very, very important to the pattern of the way that they play. The ability to hold the ball up and the ability to bring others into play. As far as that front three goes, and I don't watch Liverpool every single week, but I've seen quite a lot of Liverpool this season. And actually, I think Mane has had a much better season than Salah. And in the games where they haven't been winning recently, Mane looks much more likely to be the player who's going to rescue them. Without Firmino, they are going to have a problem. They'll need to find a slightly different way of playing because they don't have options up front. So they could play Daniel Sturridge, who has a lot of talent, but is unreliable. But it would alter slightly the way that they'd have to play. And they might think about altering something in midfield as well, because Firmino gives them a player to play off. So in midfield, they have whoever the three players are. There's usually a lack of imagination and wit and creativity in midfield. So what they do is they get the ball into Firmino and play off him and then get men forward. If you don't have a centre forward who's going to be able to hold the ball, then that creativity in midfield that's missing will be even more significant. So perhaps they'll bring Sturridge in if Firmino's injured, but they might then need to bring Shaqiri into midfield as well, because to make up for what's lacking, they might need a bit more wit and imagination, a bit more X factor in midfield. I'm not sure, but it would be dangerous to do that against Watford, to change the whole method of playing against a team that really know what they're about. But they might need some kind of freshening up, because things aren't working well for them at the moment. And in the end, because of that very prosaic midfield that will run you off the pitch, but it will never play you off the pitch, they become very reliant on their front three. And if you stop their front three, as Leicester did, as United did yesterday, they're going to find it quite difficult to score goals.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what happens and just how long it is, because you talk to the Liverpool fans and they're the ones who have recognised that Firmino is so important to them. The injury update afterwards was no update from the Liverpool website.
3 wins in 11 is really alarming, isn't it?
Unfortunately, I have no clue. It was something with the ankle, that's for sure, says Jurgen Klopp, the doctor. Bobby said at first he could carry on, but then he showed it didn't. I don't know exactly. It is Bobby, so it will be quicker than with all the others, but first we have to know what it is exactly, and we don't know that at the moment. So there you go. I'm adding to your store of knowledge by reading out the Liverpool website's injury update.
Dan makes a good point, though. Is that if that midfield, basically their job has always been in this Klopp team to just feed the front three and basically nothing else except break up play, because they don't really offer anything dynamic runs from midfield. They don't offer a lot of goals. But if Salah's had a pretty poor season all in all. He had a dreadful start to the season. He'd come off the World Cup where he'd been injured. He's barely had a break as well, for one thing.
He scored a lot of goals.
For Liverpool,
yeah,
but he scored goals against, like, with all due respect, if you're getting one goal against the top six teams, like, that's not good enough, because that means in those games you're completely going to rely on Mane and Firmino then to get the goals, because Liverpool don't really have many other options for goals. And in a lot of games he's cut a fairly frustrated figure. He looked very frustrated coming off yesterday, I thought. So the teams are probably, that Watford game now is massive, like, because Watford will definitely fancy the chance of getting something. This Liverpool team is definitely either tired or mentally wobbling a bit at the moment.
Yeah, it's natural though, right? That's going to happen at some point in the season. It's how you get through this period.
Yeah, but they shouldn't, like, there's a long way to go. They really shouldn't be getting tired like that. That means they've been over trained in a sense fairly on the season, because there's a long, long way to go yet. We're only in February, and they're obviously fighting a war on two fronts.
Yeah, well mentioned a war on many fronts. Obviously, so Manchester City get the emotional boost of having won the cup in bizarre circumstances with the Kepa situation, but they do, you know, they don't care that John Terry is angling for the Chelsea job from the Sky studio in the immediate aftermath of the game. They're just pretending to drink champagne or Carabao, whatever it is, in the aftermath. It is 120 minutes for most of their first team, though, so it's another game in those legs. Does that have any impact? Is there any negatives from winning that cup final, from having played that game, really, is what I'm asking, Dan?
I'm sure that if you've played the game like I have, you'll know that there's never a negative for winning a cup final. It is true there is another 120 minutes in the legs, but I would say that the players would always say that if you're winning, then you don't really notice. That doesn't mean it's true, but if in their mind it's true, then it can continue to be true for a bit longer. City staying in everything till the end will obviously make them more likely to slip up than not likely to slip up at some point. But at the same time, the Schalke game now, the European tie, they'd basically finished that in the first leg. They would have to play ridiculously badly to lose an away lead against Schalke. They've had a remarkable succession of easy cup draws in both cup competitions. So again, they've saved their legs there. And if Liverpool were to fall away in the league, which they might not, then there is also the possibility that they'll be able to rest players in the league too. So I think as long as you're winning, then you don't mind too much. And I doubt that City would have been doing too much complaining yesterday, watching Liverpool drop points in a really dispiriting way and winning a cup final themselves in a way that is very exciting on penalties. I mean, they probably won't have thought about the fact almost that they didn't play that well. I'm sure Pep Guardiola would have thought about it for them, but they'll just move on to the next game and think, well, we're going to win that one as well. So it is hard. I've said all along, it's hard for me to see a way that City don't win the league. And they're basically probably a game against Manchester United away from winning a domestic treble, which no one's ever done before. I think that at some point they will come unstuck in Europe. I think that defence will run into a difficulty eventually. But if they get the winners of Spurs, Borussia Dortmund in the next round, or Porto and Roma, then they're in the semi-finals of the Champions League without having played anyone, more or less. And so they are in a really strong position, because also, if you look at the Champions League, there's a lot of teams of roughly equivalent standard. Barcelona can be good, can be useless. Atletico Madrid, I quite like to see them against City. I think that would be a really interesting game to watch those two teams play. PSG can be really good. But other than that, there isn't that much. There isn't that much available that I think will concern Manchester City at all. It's just a matter of who they end up having to play. Because if City get Roma in the next round and Atletico draw Barcelona, then there's basically one difficult game to win the Champions League too. So I would say that I think they probably will fall down somewhere, because it's really hard to do. But at this point, you cannot deny that everything is available.
Yeah. Daniel, great stuff this morning. Thanks for joining us.
See you again.
It's Daniel Harris giving us some thoughts on most of the weekend's football stories. We didn't get his thoughts on Kepa, but we will at some point. It's coming. So I'm going to play you this. Nathan and Kevin Caban couldn't be... sure, they might have been at Croker on Saturday night. Was Kev at Croker on Saturday night? Or was he somewhere else?
I don't think they were. I think...
Kev was accused of being the PR wing for Mayo GAA after his lots of positives to take from that performance. Loads of the young lads did well.
We did the Dublin game.
Yeah,
right. That's a hell of a. That's
he
a
was accused by one of his colleagues here at Off the Ball. At the end of call was quick to, what are you talking about?
Yeah, justifiably
punching up. And a good man. So anyway, the lads were at Old Trafford for us yesterday. Here they are with their post match thoughts. Have a look.
So it finished Manchester United 0, Liverpool 0 here at Old Trafford. And to quote Jurgen Klopp to Ole Gunnar Solskjaer at the full-time whistle, that was a shit game, Kevin.
Well, you can't argue with that, can you? You can't argue with that.
Why was it a shit game, Kevin?
Well, do you know what? It lacked in the final third, both sides really. Was it Liverpool one shot on target? I don't really remember them seriously testing David De Gea out in goal. They tried to, I think they started the game well, and I think they got in behind United's back four a good few times. But that final cross, that final pass, and the real key moments was lacking for Liverpool today. It really was. And I think you touched on it in commentary yourself today. Liverpool have been lacking in recent weeks. They've not been as free-flowing as they have been in the early stage of this season. And that's where Liverpool felt down. I think it was the same for United as well. The final third, both sides were very poor. And that's maybe something that we can take from it, yeah.
Three draws in their last four now for Liverpool.
Yeah.
Are they bottling it?
I think it's a bit harsh to say that, isn't it? But they're just... I think they're feeling the edge that's around the games at the moment. And I think it's certainly, when you look at today, we came here, what we're talking about, we're all excited, we've got the buzz on, we're expecting free-flowing football, both sides actually going for it, we're expecting the United side to come out and attack Liverpool. I certainly was, and I think it would have suited Liverpool. It was most supposedly, in my mind, playing into the hands. I think when Liverpool will look back on the game, Liverpool, Man United, three injuries by half-time, Marcus Rashford effectively playing with injury through the second half as well. It was... I'm looking at it and I'm thinking this is an opportunity missed for Liverpool. It really is. I don't think they're bottling it. I think that's maybe a harsh term, but they're certainly they're nervy and they're a lot more edgy, yeah.
And is that the reason you think for the poor performances, the nerves, or is there something else missing? When it comes down to this part of the season, the final third of the season, is there actually something in their squad missing that they can't kick on?
Well, he brought Shaqiri on. I think he was a sort of player that they needed in this type of game today. Someone that's going to come on and change it and give them a bit of spark, a bit of creativity. And so he came on. It didn't really have an effect because of how United played against it. I think the last 15 minutes of the game, United just dropped off and said, right, come and beat us, try and get in behind us and we'll try and hit you on the counter-attack. They played like that for a majority of the game, United. I think the thing with teams that's playing against Liverpool, and they play like that, Liverpool have gone back to maybe a couple of seasons ago where they couldn't break sides down that dropped deep and defended deep against them, whereas Man City seem to are a lot more or a lot easier in opening that type of system. I think Liverpool got over it, they were able to do it a lot more. At the moment, I just don't think they're able to open up sides that are playing a certain way against them.
It's difficult to criticise Jurgen Klopp when you look at what Liverpool are achieving this season and have done over the last couple of years, but he seems on edge. Right from the first minute he was at his players, he's right in the edge of the technical area for the entire 90 minutes. And yeah. Like there was when Jordan Henderson came off and Henderson just walked straight past him, clearly angry. It feels as though everybody's on edge.
Yeah.
Like, does the manager need to somehow calm that down, or is that changing him and everything that's actually made him so great?
I think that's right. I don't think he's going to change his style. You can't say that he's not been for a majority of the games that he's managed at Liverpool within his technical area. You're looking back even when he was at Dortmund, exactly the same style in his technical area, trying to get the team motivated and trying to get... He almost living with the players. He's feeling what the players are feeling. I don't think he's going to change that, but there is an edge. There is a certain edge around Liverpool's play at the moment. Look at Mo Salah today. First touch letting him down continuously throughout that game. Allowing Luke Shaw to snap into him. Sadio Mane, not as free-flowing as he was. Firmino, before he got injured and came off, not as dynamic as he was. So, Liverpool are lacking. I think that they are, in certain areas now, they're not as, I don't know, as confident as what we saw them earlier on this season. And first touch and whatever it will be, usually goes when you're not confident.
One of the good stories today, I think, was Luke Shaw's performance. Probably his best performance in a Manchester United jersey. And considering the criticism he's taken over the last couple of years, a lot of very personal criticism about his attitude to training, his attitude to the game. Like, to dominate Mo Salah like that, there's not many players who can do that.
No, he did. I thought he was superb today. I think he'd probably want to add to that, to his own game by getting forward more. I think he'd see himself as a good attacking fullback, and he wasn't really able to do that today. I think his mindset today, I'm going to stop Mo Salah, which is brilliant. First of all, I'd say that's your job. Do that job correctly, and then everything else can flow off the back of that. So maybe that's maybe something that needs to be added, needs to be a bit more dynamic, maybe creating more chances in games. But up against Mo Salah today was outstanding. Every time Salah got the ball, I said before, I think what Salah was doing, his first touch was letting him down, simply because he was expecting Luke Shaw to come and snap into him immediately with that challenge, and that's why it was letting him down. But yeah, in a one-on-one position today, Luke Shaw was first class, top class defending from him. Yeah,
10 games unbeaten now for Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. They have dropped out of the top four because of Arsenal's victory. I mean, how different is what you saw today from what we saw at Anfield 2 months ago?
Well, we saw at Anfield a capitulation, didn't we? We saw players that weren't playing for a manager. We saw players that were seriously lacking confidence. I don't think they were great today by any stretch of the imagination, but I think we saw a resolute, a strong performance, winners that wanted actually to get through this game and not get beat. With all the injury problems that they had, I think you've seen a little bit of steel to United today. Great atmosphere at Old Trafford again today as well, and all the football wasn't maybe reflective of that, but it was hopping from the start of the game to the end of the game. I think they were right with the team, and that's certainly something. The vibe around Old Trafford has seriously changed. Yeah,
it was more disappointing, Mayo's performance last night or this game?
Oh, Mayo, of course. Bloody hell. Yeah,
bloody hell. Yeah. On that note, more needs to be said. Yeah. Cheers, Kev.
Yeah, the Manchester Convention of the Mayo People of the Year Awards giving their votes to Luke Shaw, it turns out, yesterday after the game.
They probably have one of them in Manchester, like these Mayo diaspora, like, you know, they love a good party, don't they?
Well, it'd be in Preston more likely than Preston, Manchester. Yeah. But Kev has been Mayo Person of the Year in the past.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm and sure he will
future,
be again.
No doubt, yeah,
yeah. Yeah. How are you?
Good morning, Ger. Not too bad.
Should be mentioned that this is a Shells fan beside me. Thought they were going to have a shocking start to the season. 2-0 down in Galway. And our guest on Saturday, Kieran Kilduff, got two goals and Shells turned it around.
3-2. Yeah. Two goals in quick succession.
Were you at the game?
I was, yeah. Michael D was there, 2,200 or so at the game.
He led a parade up to the
game. Yeah, so they called it Reclaim the Dyke. So the Dyke Road is the road that goes to Terryland Park. And down the years, everyone walked to the game. So it was kind of like trying to invoke the past kind of patterns of
marching walking. Your traditional route.
Yeah, and yeah. I didn't think we'd get the marches in there to the show today. But it was just, I suppose...
You just dropped your mic there.
My mic is
gone. Yeah, it's gone. So, yeah. Forces intervened. Dark forces intervened. I'll do the competition in the meantime. Right. As Ireland prepare for their penultimate Guinness Six Nations clash against France at the Aviva Stadium, the official partner, Dove Men Plus Care, is giving you the chance to be part of the captain's run. The winner will join the IRFU kitman, John Moran, as he prepares the dressing room for the Irish rugby team ahead of their final training session before the big game. And if that isn't enough, the winner also receives a pair of tickets to see Ireland against France at the Aviva the following day. To give him the chance to win, we just want you to tell us what is your favourite rugby jersey. You can tweet us or comment while you're watching the show. Make sure you use the hashtag TeamCare and the hashtag OTBAM so we know that you have entered.
How do you actually win it? So, like,
it's all in association with Dove Men Plus Care. We pick...
You pick the best jersey or whatever.
Yeah, well, we'll run through and then we'll pick a winner every morning and there'll be a draw.
Yeah, so that kind of decides on points.
There. So it'd be nice if you tell us what year, Tegan, that... Which year is that? Is that the current one? No. It is, isn't it?
Last year, I think.
Yeah, I thought that the... That's the old Connacht one.
Horrific.
That's a horrible jersey.
That's
It's for kids. It's like a superhero.
It was not even a good superhero. It's the Green Lantern.
Parma, UNESCO, City of Gastronomy. Okay, that is Ebra, yeah. Good spot.
Wow.
Yeah, all right, so there you go. Darren.
We will start with the Six Nations, and there were frustrated figures all around as Ireland got out of Rome with a win. They made it back-to-back victories by beating Italy 26-16, although it was the unconvincing nature which left many fans unhappy. Head coach Joe Schmidt admits his half-back pairing just as angry as anyone who watched the game. Johnny Sexton kicked a towel in frustration as he left the field during Ireland's unconvincing win at the Stadio Olimpico in Rome. Conor Murray unhappy with the uncharacteristic errors that have littered his recent performances for Ireland. Schmidt feels that the team are desperately in need of a confidence boost.
You know, there's a real danger in you start trying too hard. And then you start trying too hard and you tend to create pressure on yourself and then you don't play well. You play best when your confidence is good, you have a sense of responsibility, and that you combine the two to be fluent in what you're delivering. And unfortunately for us, we weren't cohesive enough right through that first half that it grew.
Now, not a mutiny, but a misunderstanding. That's how Kepa Arrizabalaga has explained his actions in the League Cup final. The keeper refused to be substituted before the penalty shootout loss to Manchester City. After twice receiving treatment towards the end of the game for cramp, manager Mauricio Sarri was ready to haul him off, with Willy Caballero primed to take his place for the closing stages and the penalty shootout. Kepa refused to leave the field as he felt he was able to continue. Sarri furious on the sideline, and at one stage looked like he was about to walk away and leave the stadium, which has left fans questioning the explanation he gave after the game.
You say it was a misunderstanding, but basically your player has ignored your authority. I mean, not coming off the pitch, he's ignored your authority.
Oh, you can remain with your opinion, of course.
You don't see it like that.
I told you the truth. It was really a big misunderstanding because I understood that he had a cramp. So we needed to change because I didn't want a goalkeeper with a cramp. To the penalties, and the goalkeeper told me from the pitch, no, I am able to play, but I realized all the situation only when I spoke to the doctor after 3-4 minutes, and in the meantime the misunderstanding went on.
But I saw you walk past me even after the game had finished. You still look very angry.
Yes, of course, because as I said before, he was right for the reason, but in the wrong way for the conduct.
I'm sorry I have to ask you this, but after today, you still have the backing of your players in the dressing room, yeah?
If you saw the player, the match, you have the answer.
Now, yeah. Get some player reaction to this. Vincent Kompany says he was delighted to see Willy Caballero not come on because he'd actually won them a penalty shootout a few years ago in a League Cup final. David Luiz says he actually told Arrizabalaga to respect Mauricio Sarri's decision to take him off.
David, everyone says it's a misunderstanding, but it did look like a player was basically saying, I'm not coming off, and
so... What do you want me to say? No. I said already, I also think it was misunderstood, but if you think a different thing, you can write what you want.
The players are still behind the manager, yeah?
Yeah, I love the way he plays. I love his as a man. He's a fantastic person, so of course the players with him.
Fantastic person.
Got it.
What if it is a big misunderstanding? What if Sarri just in the moment was really angry?
No, it wasn't.
What if? Yeah.
It's not good.
It's not good.
No, yeah, it looks really bad.
Should be my uncle.
But what? I don't know why you'd come out and defend the player in that situation.
I think
he cost 80 million quid. What are you going to do?
Yeah,
throw him under the bus like he deserves to be. If he was genuinely being like, you know what, this manager's going to be out of here soon enough. I'm staying on. I'm not leaving. Say that's what he did. If that's what he did,
but everybody knows that's what he did, right? So you don't need to be the one. If you're so Sarri is looking at his next job and he's looking at what the next owner who wants to employ him thinks, like, okay, that guy, he's got a bit of class. He rose above this. He took one for the club and the team, has protected the assets, and sure, he's getting fired, but he's going to get a good payoff for it. Abramovich is going to look after him for this.
Yeah, but as soon as Kepa stops being in the team, we're going to know that. There's probably a bit more to that than we were led to believe at the time.
Kepa's going to continue playing.
Really?
Like, I think so, yeah. And
like he should 100% be dropped for that. Like he should be out of the club.
Well, he'll be injured now because there was cramp, but it was actually hamstring, and they'll discover hamstring. So,
right.
But he won't be out of the club because it's too expensive. They just spent 80 million on him.
But is this a sign of players being bigger than the manager now? Like when you look at Pogba, player power is becoming for the brand in Asia and all that.
Fine him £1 million and he won't do that shite again.
Absolutely.
Make it impossible for him. Do it. Yeah. Liverpool manager Jurgen Klopp says he's looking on the bright side after their goalless draw with Manchester United. The Reds reclaimed top spot in the Premier League with a 0-0 draw at Old Trafford, and Klopp feels it's a point gained, not two dropped.
I'm not here to be frustrated. In this moment, I have only to say what I saw. I'm not frustrated. I always take what I get from the boys, so that's how it is. And it doesn't feel world class in the moment, but that's okay. We have a point more, so that's now it's a situation clear.
Now, the SSE Airtricity League table toppers Shamrock Rovers hope to make it three wins on the spin tonight. The top two go head-to-head at Dalymount Park. As the Hoops play fellow form team Bows, the Gypsies have taken maximum points from games with Finn Harps and UCD. Rovers have navigated a tough start to the season by beating Waterford and Derry. Action begins at 7:45. The Dublin clubs have enjoyed a good start to the new season. St Pat's have defeated Cork City and Sligo Rovers tonight. They meet Finn Harps. Stuttering Dundalk look for their first win at the third attempt. The champions face UCD at Oriel Park. Derry hope to bounce back after losing to Rovers last Friday night. They face Waterford tonight, while last season's runners-up Cork City hope to avoid a third straight defeat. They play Sligo Rovers.
Just on that, actually, Waterford are playing Derry today, so you can imagine that's like as a bus ride, that's definitely the guts of 5 hours to go from Waterford to Derry. You pretty much go via Dublin. They're travelling today.
The game's tonight.
Yeah, I can't see how that's any way ideal. And I think it may be to do with the fact that they don't really have the money to put the players up overnight or whatever. But if you're talking about Dundalk or Cork playing against, say, Derry or having an equivalent journey, there's absolutely no way I would have thought they'd be travelling the day of the game. A 5 hour journey is a 5 hour journey. And they have to go, having played on Friday night as well and had a tough game in Cork. But interestingly, just without going on forever about the League of Ireland, if Cork lose to Sligo tonight, John Caulfield has to be under serious pressure.
Don't be ridiculous.
That would be three defeats.
The start of the season.
Yeah.
Well, that would be ridiculous, I think. Anyway, we'll come back to that. Are you done?
I've got one more story. Tomás O'Shea believes the GAA are not in touch with grassroots members. The Kerry legend feels the decision to allow Dublin to continue to play two Super 8 games at Croke Park shows a disconnect between the rule makers and the members. Donegal tabled a motion aimed at preventing any team from nominating the same ground as both home and neutral venue. The proposal defeated by 64% to 36, meaning the All-Ireland champions will play two out of their three Super 8 games in Croke Park. He's told RTE, Congress is supposed to be a democracy, but I don't think it is. It's a small percentage of people who run it their own way. To me, there's a total disconnect between the rule makers and the players and the people on the ground. I think it's unfair.
We'll come back to this a little bit later on, and maybe Darren will come in and defend the indefensible for us. Right. Let's move on, because we're going back to the rugby. Ronan O'Gara is with us this morning. Ronan, you're very welcome. I want to start by reminding you about the year 2007, because it came up in conversation amongst your Virgin Media colleagues in the aftermath of the game. Shane Horgan says there's effectively just a worrying bang of 2007 off what's going on with the team at the moment. Do you agree with that?
No, I wouldn't, because I think 2007 was... I think the boys now are probably going through a slump, while for us, at that time, we were training the house down, genuine ambition to win in the World Cup, thought we could do it, sure, and you get there and... Oh, what a disappointment. Incredibly disappointing. And one of the biggest disappointments of my career. If we could do it again, I think it was definitely, we just needed someone to kind of say, boys, it's kind of less is more. Yeah. Sometimes we completely overtrained, I think, and just, I think it's very hard to compare. We never had a year like the lads have had in 2018. I think that's the slump that they're trying to deal with. I think they have to be careful about judging by the public standards and judging by their own standards. But yesterday was disappointing, no doubt about it. But to say 2007, I would think is, I wouldn't go along with that.
What was the reason that yesterday was disappointing? Because it wasn't our first choice team by any stretch of the imagination, and yet we still managed an away bonus point.
I don't think we have ever kind of talked about this what's different about this group is I think they have an awful lot more strength and depth, but maybe this season has told us that the strength and depth isn't as strong, or maybe it is as strong, depending on what your outlook is on the senior players. Is there a more competition? Are a few of them under pressure for their places? Or I suppose that's what's going to happen in the next two games, and the warm-up games now against Wales and England are two juicy games. So there's probably a lot at stake in terms of, I think what the first three games have said, no, it's probably harder to name the Irish team now than it was at the start of the Six Nations. And I think also for the first time in maybe 40 games, I saw an Italian team that were really, really capable of playing. I didn't see anything of them before yesterday. I don't know, was it the fact I was up at 4 a.m. to watch the game, or was it, which was a bit of a strange buzz. But I think I thought they were intense. They played with tempo. They threw the ball out in front of each other. They looked to know what they were doing. Everyone kind of bought into it. Tibaldi was excellent at nine, and what a crowd. I just think that has been missing. You know, I think most definitely, like, this is the same team that I saw. I know it was a friendly in Chicago, but when I went to watch that game, I was kind of convinced that Italy didn't know how to play rugby. But looking at them yesterday, they were good, and I would have to agree for the first time with Conor O'Shea that, judging what we saw yesterday, they have made big progress in the fact that they look like a rugby team.
Because the consensus here has been that we're giving them too much credit. If Peter Manny comes out afterwards and says, look, they were a good team, and the consensus in the studio afterwards was that they're not a good team at the moment, and they're not playing, that Conor Shea's not doing a great job, and that they're not playing.
Yeah, well, I suppose, that's a few people's opinions too. That's the beauty of sport in Ireland. I think everyone, and I mean, there's a lot of good opinions out there. I would say that whatever happens in Peter's case there, he's captain, he's played 80 minutes, he's grabbed by the Irish PR man, and he said, OK, put a positive spin in this, Peter. And Peter's an honest guy, and he kind of, he had to toe the line and go, yeah, it was we're not far off, we know we're not on top of our game, but we get there, and basically didn't enjoy the interview. And I think they would be disappointed with certain aspects in the fact that Italy probably played well with the ball, better than I thought any of us thought they did. But they're not. You can't say they're a very good team. So from Ireland's point of view, as you say, it was a bit of a scratch side. But these guys are going to be going to the World Cup too, so it's not that scratch.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about what you would do if you were coaching this team now, in terms of trying to improve the form and the sense of confidence that they have. What's Joe Schmidt saying this week to this team to try and get them back to a level that they're capable of playing at?
Well, Joe, if I knew that, I'd be coaching Ireland, wouldn't I? I think it's actually probably, it's good now that they have a kind of another week off. I think in the fact that they don't play next weekend, and they've got taste the opposition. The result in terms of, from Ireland's point of view, in terms of France beating Scotland, you'd be surprised how much of a shot of confidence France will get from that. I know it's only one game out of the blue, but the way their mentality is, the fact that they will go now, okay, we've beaten Scotland, the monkey's off our back, we're going to just play. And I actually think France picked a team that play in their positions for their clubs, and that's probably a contradiction in the fact that Entomac doesn't really play a 10 for his club, but Fico and Bastro are a lovely combination, and their back three was good, and up front I think they brought in people that they know that can do a job. So I would say training becomes a lot more important than it has been in Camp Ireland for a long time, and the fact that I think there'll probably be, going back to the good old days, it won't be called it, but you could potentially have an A versus B kind of game, or you could have a complete mixed game of 30 going at it for 20 minutes. And depending on how that goes, and depending on if you're picking on form, I think that could be how selection for France is decided.
There's a lot.
There are injuries in the backs. There's injuries in the back row. I think Ireland are probably one guy who's definitely probably missed, I think, with and without the ball is Levy. I think his abrasiveness is probably something that is missing at the minute. But 2 second rows were good yesterday, I thought. And I thought Earlsey was very sharp from an Irish point of view.
Yeah, Earlsey's at that level of consistency now where he can do that in any game and you kind of think, well, that's what we expect because he's genuinely world-class at the minute. Just to talk to us about the...
Yeah, it is sure, but there's a few of them that aren't doing that either, that are, you know what I mean, in that bracket as well. So it just shows that you have to kind of... You have to work it, and sometimes when it's going against you, you kind of just need to probably display your character, even if your form is probably not where you want it to be. But, you know, I think what probably Joe would be a little bit concerned with would potentially be the body language. I know they weren't winning, or like they'd like to win, but it was still a bonus point win. But I think from an Irish point of view, you wanted probably... a little bit maybe more of a smile on the face, if that's possible. I know it's a 10-point victory, but at the same time, in that environment when it's very pressurised, sometimes you need to just make the mood light at times if you can.
He said that he thinks that Conor Murray is trying a bit too hard at the moment, and that kind of the 9 and 10 has been a lot of the focus for just what is the form of our two best and most important players. Two genuinely world-class players who've been, you know, the dominant players in their positions in the world, or at least in the top two for the last half decade, and they're not playing well at the moment.
Yeah, it's definitely an issue, I think, in the fact that Conor has had an injury, and he has been probably mixed. I wouldn't say that he's been completely out of form, in the fact that I think for early on for Munster was one game in particular I thought he was really impressive. Then he went off the boil a little bit, then he's come back. But I think what you admire about Conor, I think, even when things, he dropped a few early balls yesterday, but I felt he kept grinding away. I think, you know what I mean, I don't know what the reason for him taking over the kicking, but that's probably, to us, it might be a big thing, but for a fella that isn't a regular kicker to do that and do it with aplomb is a fair feather in his cap to be able to do that. And Johnny hasn't played enough minutes to be hitting anywhere near the form he wants to be hitting. And you could see it yesterday, probably even in something like his line kicking or his restarts. They just weren't of the standard he'd expect them to be.
That's the type of thing that comes back, though, right? Like, you know, he's not going to be bad at restarts the next time he plays because he's going to go and practice him this week. And, like, these are tiny little things that come back quite quickly to players at that level.
Yeah, of course, yeah. And on the flip side of it then, Jur, is that sport, you know, at that level, when you kind of have momentum, it just runs so smoothly. You look at, I suppose, the mindset of them when they literally kind of played New Zealand off the park. There was just a flow to their game. There was an edge to them that for the first three games isn't there. But I think sometimes when you dig for it, it's harder to find it. And I don't know, because I don't have the solution to that, because I was in that position myself as well as a player. And I never got full circle on the solution on it, because the group we were in, we went digging and it meant so much to us, and we went after it, and you just put everything on hold, and then you actually find yourself in a bigger hole. So I look forward to the psychologist who can inform me, please.
Yeah, I think maybe that's the problem. That's the bit of this cycle that we're in at the minute that's reminiscent of 2007, is that you kept digging in 2007 and didn't get anywhere. So the fear is that this team keeps digging.
No, I think, you know what I mean, irrespective of what happens in the Six Nations, there's plenty of time to address it.
Yeah.
That's the beauty of this. And, you know what I mean, you're talking about 12 years on, and you look at the psyche of Irish sport over the last 12 years. We've gone from a kind of an era of glorious failures at certain stages to, I would like to think, a merited top three rugby team in the world.
There's two quick things I want to ask you about before we go here. One is Dan Biggar's performance off the bench. Surely good enough to get the start the next time Wales play?
I wouldn't think so, no. I actually thought I was just reading there because I was in shock over his proposal, seven-figure move to Bath. I think that's on the table. I thought he was good, if not very good, in the fact it's a different game for the first hour. England, I think, when I was watching it, and maybe I was delusional at this hour of the night because I was at their game, watched the Crusaders game when I came home from 12 till 2 in the morning, watched Scotland France from 2 till 4, and I watched England Wales from 4 till 7. So at that stage, I was rugbyed out, but I thought, watching it, I was full sure England were going to win. And I was only after the kind of hour mark at 10-9, I was kind of saying, Jesus, Wales, in fairness to them, have an incredible capacity to hang in there and play from being on the ropes for so long. And I think they have a lovely, I think, mix in the two of them now. I think Anscombe is a lovely runner. And I think Bigger then just has a capacity to scan a game for an hour and come off the bench like a lot of smart players and make a killer impact, because it's amazing in sport when you have the opportunity to kind of land a knockout blow and you don't do it. England had a few chances and they couldn't put Wales away, and you knew Wales with the home advantage, 1 point down, it was like, okay, England have a question mark over them, knowing where the finishing line is in big games. So they tapped into that, and I thought, the cross kick was brilliant, yeah, but as a kicker, is it better than the leap of the winger, catching the ball above his head and out-jumping Elliot Daly? No, it's not. It's a fantastic bit of feeling, I think, to score a try, which you've probably very little rights to score, sure.
Yeah. So that Wales performance was the kind of perfect Wales performance then against a team like England, where you suck them in and you withstand that onslaught in a way that Ireland didn't. And then you start to put the doubts in their mind.
Yeah, but also I think, like, sure, I would think that England were 40% off than they played us, I would think. I didn't see that crazy line speed and the unbelievably diligent spacing all over the pitch. I didn't see Farrell's accuracy with the boot. I saw it maybe 6 out of 10 times, but like against Ireland, he nailed it 9.5 times out of 10. Probably didn't put a foot wrong all day. He had a few errors against Wales, and there was also one or two errors from Elliot Daly.
Yeah, unusual. The other thing, I was glad this morning to wake up and read the New Zealand press are as obsessed with your next coaching job as we are in this part of the world. They've got you anointed as either the next Crusaders coach or second in command with the All Blacks.
No, you didn't read the article correctly.
I did. Anything is possible, you said.
I only did, that's on, what time is it now? I only did that interview, I did press today out on the side of the pitch at 3 o'clock. So that's the beauty of your game, as you know. You never see the questions that are asked, do you? So please give me the full hearing.
Yeah.
But, yeah, of course, but sure, it's sure could easily be an option, you know.
There's a general assumption that what happens after the World Cup in New Zealand is that the Crusaders' current head coach is going to get the All Black gig. There's a lot of...
Is that the talk in Ireland?
Well, that's what it says. So this is the New Zealand... I'm just reading the New Zealand Herald piece. They're kind of assuming that it's Scott Robertson. Is that his name?
Yeah.
That he's like next in line, essentially, for the All Blacks gig. You obviously have a good relationship with him.
Yeah, well, he's my boss. Yeah, he's the head coach here, and obviously, I think your relationship with your coach when you're a player is very different to relationship with your coach when you're an assistant coach. So from that point of view, I've only had, I suppose, two bosses in Racing, and then in a complete different environment. I've had Razor as my boss, so that's only 7 years, so it's not as if I'm on the circuit 20 or 30 years, you know, so I'm just probably getting a taste of what it's like. But in terms of, I suppose lots of people in their work don't like their boss, but I actually like my boss, and he's I look forward to going into work every day, which I think is, and I wouldn't even call it work, going into Rugby Park every day, which makes it something that I have a passion for doing.
What are you learning at the moment from him? What's different about what you're learning here from what you would have been learning in Paris, for example?
I don't know, because I've never coached in Ireland, so it's hard for me to say. But in France, it's a different model. It's very much a directive in terms of telling the players, while in the Crusaders, would be very much a pre-meetings, discuss, decide, apply, commit to it, hear out people's opinions. A lot of terms of the why. Tell me why this will work. Show me how it'll work. Give me pictures and tell me if you do this and you do this, there's a fair chance there'll be a line break. So they want to tell, they're mad into the critical view and mad into why. You can't just say we're doing this or we want to do this. No good. Show me why it'll work. So it's a good way, because it kind of takes away the guesswork.
Yeah, and it gets buy-in straight away, right? Because if they don't believe,
it gets buy-in, exactly. But then you have some great minds that also, if you're trying to, I can easily say, Jar, I'm wrong a lot of the times and I've no problem. But there's times when you're right as well. But at least give me a counter argument if you have something. Don't just sit there and nod your head at me. Agree with me, disagree with me. And then I think the power of 17 minds in a back squad is far more powerful than my mind.
The hive mind is always the best one. One last thing, we're running a competition this morning. People are sending in their favourite rugby jerseys of all time. If you had to pick one jersey, you'd either played in or against, what was your favourite ever?
Oh, favourite jersey ever.
I like the Ireland 03 World Cup jersey, that was good. I like the Munster Navy one, that was good.
Yeah.
Wow.
Jeez, I know I like a pause, but I'm probably doing the dogging it at this stage.
Because look, it's not the radio, they would have kicked in the emergency tape.
What's my favourite jersey? Jess reckons my Munster one. Yeah, Jar agrees with you.
Very good. The Navy one.
Yes. Was that the 06 or 08 campaign?
Yeah.
When in doubt, ask the missus.
Yeah. The Toyota across it. Good stuff. Thanks a million.
Are we going to review the race now, Johnny, will we?
Yeah, lots to review. What's your Cheltenham nap?
Oh, God, I don't know. Jeez, I'm way out of touch, but...
You want to give another long pause here, are you?
Yeah, I'll go on. Should I chat to you during the week? See you, boys.
Thanks a million, Ronan. Cheers. Take care.
Oh, see you.
What a legend. You know, just that just was not a conventional interview. He's just so relaxed. It's like, yeah, this is how it is. And, you know, I don't care if this is an interview or if I'm on Skype. You know, I'm going to answer my questions methodically. And then he throws in a race-related comment at the end.
Just to great stuff. Hand her into the crowd there.
He's had a bit of success with horses. He had a horse called You're Busy for James Nash that won, and he'd a very nice horse with David Watchman, who I can't remember the name, but it was a Canford Cliffs horse. But he's had some success. Obviously, he loves his racing, and he didn't give you a bullshit answer either to your question about, he didn't exactly give a yes or no answer, but he kind of confronted... The media reports today about the New Zealand situation.
Yeah, well, so he's on the touchline and being asked about the fact that the All Blacks, the New Zealand press are effectively giving the current Crusaders coach the All Blacks job in the immediate aftermath of the World Cup because Steve Hansen is stepping down.
So what? Why is it automatically assumed that the Crusaders head coach gets the job?
Because he's been unbeaten in two seasons. And yeah. The team plays amazing he's rugby. And
top dog over there.
Yeah, at the moment, yeah. There was like a, would you go with them? Yeah, I might do if he took me. Would you put your hat in for the Crusaders job if he goes? Yeah, if it's the right thing to do. So it's like, my options are open, whatever happens.
When does he coach Ireland?
I don't know, probably a while. Like, what's the rush? Andy Farrell's got the gig until the next World Cup, effectively, barring some kind of mid-cycle disaster. So that's 4 years. Like, that's 2023, you know?
In terms of O'Gara, to be coaching in France and New Zealand, it must give you some level of experience that, like, it must be, like, you can't even put a price on the experience that he's gaining. And if he were to get the Kiwis job then, I mean, his credentials for the Ireland job, what more does he need to learn?
Well, the other thing is, so I hadn't heard Dan Biggar to Bath for £1 million. Was that the contract? What was it? I was so busy being shocked about the seven-figure deal.
That's what he said, wasn't it?
Yeah. That amount of money that you're able to make, the Ireland head coach job doesn't get paid that much. So, like, if you're, you know, you would go to France for a couple of years and be the head coach of a French team or a couple of French teams and make, wouldn't you?
I guess you would. It's mad, though.
Take the Ireland job in your 50s when you want it.
Yeah, it's mad for his family, though, that you have to have so much respect for his wife and kids that they, you know, to go to France, like they lived in France for quite a few years, didn't they? They're probably learning, speaking French almost at that stage. And then obviously they're shuttled off to the other end of the world, further away from Ireland. And you really got to respect them for
Danscombe getting £1 million from Bath, right? Jesus.
That's obviously big.
Yeah, it is big.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have said he was worth £1 million just yet.
What's £1 million in rugby terms? That's
the
lot.
Second highest paid player in the world. So there was some suggestion that Toulon were playing Sevilla £1 million, but then they tried to sack him a couple of weeks ago, and then the figure came out for Manu Tuilagi to go to Racing, and that's 850 a year.
It's interesting what he said there, though. He's kind of alluding to the fact that the French game is not a kind of a formality for Ireland now, and I think if you look at it, it might be a lot better for Ireland that France are coming into it on the up, so they're going to offer them something of a test rather than the rubbish that they produced against England.
Yeah,
we need a test now with so many. There are obviously a lot of doubts. Three fairly poor performances so far. So it's almost like we need to know where they are, and they need to face a French team that actually will offer something.
What are we in? February now, and the World Cup warm-ups will be September, and the World Cup itself will be October. So we've got loads of time for players to play their way into form, for the club size to have a good season, for Conor Murray's injury to clear up to the point where he has the same strength and confidence in both arms. Like, I think it's a bit early to be hitting the panic button, but you can understand why people are, given our... It's a bit like the Liverpool fans who are absolutely terrified.
I think the Liverpool panic is a lot more real, though, because I think Daniel's figures might be slightly wrong. Somebody on Twitter contradicted the 3 wins from 11 or whatever, but Liverpool are not playing well. Liverpool have issues, and it looks like Daniel was very confident that Man City are going to win the league. The Ireland situation is more... Like, they lost to England, but apart from that, they've won the other two games. They've chopped and changed a lot. Sexton's obviously, you know, he's not anywhere near 100% at the moment. And they still have a chance, some sort of a chance winning the group, with a view to the fact that the Six Nations isn't the be-all and end-all this year. But it's not a crisis, surely. Like, they've so many players just not playing at the moment.
It's mainly a crisis because every time we go to the World Cup, we underperform and we fail.
And doubt is creeping in again.
Yeah, it's like it's the movie that you've seen a million times, and you're like driving towards the cliff, and you're like, oh, this cliff looks fairly familiar. It's the same cliff that we always go off. Why are we on the same?
Yeah.
What can we do to try and who is going to be the one that pulls the handbrake, that wrestles the?
One other thing he said, though, which I found interesting, there must be a huge doubt about what is the best 15 now. Like, if you ask 10 people to name the team against in the France game, Would even one of them get it right?
Well, so if your criteria is everybody fit, I think we're getting much closer to knowing what the first 15 is. The players who are coming in, who are being given the opportunity, this is their audition period, and not that many of them are passing the auditions. some of them are getting up the pecking order in terms of their role as like numbers 28, 29, 30, 31. But I'd say the first 15 is almost cast in stone.
Once they're all fit.
Yeah. I think that, like, so Rory Best didn't play and we lost six lineouts from 20, or was it four from 20? Was it four?
Four from 20.
I think it might have been more than that.
Yeah, that was Quinny's figure,
anyway.
But the Carberry thing is a bit unfortunate as well, because Carberry obviously had a big wobble against Scotland. He came through the second half with the try and all that. And yesterday would have been a great chance for him to gain more match experience and coming off and seeing where he is versus Sexton. And him being obviously out for 2 or 3 weeks didn't help, because Sexton needs cover at the moment.
And needs game time. I think that's, like, with a player like Sexton, you know that he's going to be able to get back to the level. We just need to navigate your way to
You know
that. I think so. I think that, like,
that man has taken a hell of a battering, though.
But his career is full of these bits where there's like 3 or 4 months where he's not at his best, and then he gets a run of games and he is absolutely fine and back to one of the best players in the world.
I was talking to a guy about this yesterday. Was he not effectively concussed in the Scotland game?
He failed
HIA.
That doesn't necessarily mean,
right?
You know, there's like a range of outcomes that would mean that you would fail a HIA and that might not necessarily
be concussion.
Yeah. So I think it's a precautionary measure more than anything. And there's no way that you're going to risk that for a game against Italy.
Sure.
Like, I think, so let's go here. It's Joe Schmidt speaking after the win against Italy about the attention that Sexton received and Bundyaki's injury. Have a look.
No, he just got a bump when I think the same guy got him twice in a row. It just looked like he was looking for him, and fair play to him, he got him. So he was a bit sore. Yeah, Bundy. Yeah, he was withdrawn because of an HIA. He did everything in the HIA with no problem. Because the medics felt that he wasn't presenting on the field, on the pitch, even though he got involved in play post the actual incident, they felt that he wasn't in the right condition to continue. And so we're always going to err on the side of caution, and that's what we did. I mean, Bundy's already tapping me on the shoulder saying, can he play for Connacht next week, because he didn't get enough of a game today. So, you know, he is very, very keen to immediately get the boots back on and play again.
You're going to love Peter O'Mahony's expressions on that interview.
Stony face, I believe.
Looks could kill, you know.
He's not very happy.
No. He looks like he could literally assassinate you with that look.
All right, let's move on, because the other big story from GAA World at the weekend was Congress happened. Not that debated series of motions of Congress, with the possible exception of the one that was put forward by the Donegal County Board about home venues in the Super 8s. Mick McGrath is the County Board Chairman of Donegal GAA and joins us on the line now this morning. Mick, good morning to you. How are you doing?
Good morning, George.
Can you tell us a little bit about how you felt the debate actually went on Saturday afternoon? Ultimately, your proposal was beaten at roughly a 2-1 majority. Were you disappointed that you didn't find more support for your motion?
Well, we have to say we were. The motion came from our members in Donegal during the Super 8s last summer, and it was felt that a simple question was asked that we just didn't have the answer for. How can a county declare a venue that is deemed to be neutral also as a home venue? Now, we know the exceptional circumstances that Dublin have in hiring of Croke Park for their games. And this was totally exaggerated then, I think, but with the defence of it, that we were trying to move Dublin out of Croke Park altogether. And it was very difficult to fight against that when we didn't have much defence, except for ourselves, myself and our Centre Council delegate. We're basically the only two that were defending it. And we weren't trying to move Dublin out from the O'Byrne Cup, National League, Leinster Championship, or in semi-finals or finals. It was just a one game in the quarter-finals. And the reasoning behind that is that it was deemed that there would be a neutral game. a home game and an away game of the three games in the group that's played. But then when you've got one county that can declare the ground as a neutral and a home base, then we find that difficult. Our members were very, very puzzled by that, and they asked us to try to sort it out and try to get some fairness in it. And it did come down to that one word, unfair. And it was drummed up that we were trying to muscle in on getting Dublin removed completely out of Croke Park, and that was not the case of our motion whatsoever. And we were quite disappointed it didn't get more support. But we have to accept democracy from the floor. It's a big place to bring anything. A motion like that was always going to get a lot of debate, and I suppose Dublin defended it quite strongly. And we have no difficulty with that. We probably would have had a difficulty with some of the wording that was used in the defence of it, but and indeed we would have had a major difficulty with some of the wording that was used by one particular individual who spoke first on it.
The bits you had difficulty with were that the motion was divisive, was that it?
Well, that type of wording was done, but people use words in their defence, like, and I mean, we're big boys and it's a big world, and we're quite careful to accept that, and I mean, we have a good relationship with the Dublin, with John Costello from Dublin. There was no difficulty with him and any of the words he used, you know, okay, he used some choice language, but we accept that, we're big boys. It was probably some of the words that was used by Sean Kelly that were, you know, if there was any divisiveness, it came from him, not from us, and we would have had a good enough relationship with him down through the years, and we weren't looking for any favourism from anybody. We were only looking for one word, fairness. We don't feel that there's fairness in the motion at the moment, the way it stands. And that's why we brought it to Congress. But to say that we were negative, it was an addressing that the people from Donegal are negative. We're far from negative. And we at no stage are afraid or concerned about playing Dublin Croke Park. We play them there, you know, many, many a time. The last county to have beaten them in the championship there. So there's no difficulty going to Croke Park at any stage. And it was saying that we were trying to not to play games in Croke Park. It had nothing at all to do with that, with counties not playing in Croke Park. It had the unfairness of the way it is stated at the moment, that a county can actually use it as a neutral venue and also as a home venue. So we were not looking for two games of the quarterfinals to be played in Ballybuffet. We're quite happy to play one of them in Ballybuffet. And so why should any county be allowed to play two of their games out of the three in the one venue?
Just from the outside looking in, Mick, and if somebody were only sort of half interested in Gaelic games, and he or she would know that people want Dublin to be challenged, and they certainly want other counties to... with the state that football is in at the moment, it probably needs a very competitive championship, I would argue, because people are slightly losing interest with it, but... Just from the outside looking in, can you explain why something like this would be defeated? Because if you asked the man on the street, he'd probably completely agree with you.
Well, I think, you know, one has to be realistic and realise that it came down to the amount of people that would attend such a match. And if Dublin haven't got an inter-county ground, they've played games in Parnell Park, and as the GAA has... risen in Dublin, I suppose, over the last 15 years, they started coming back into Croke Park and renting the stadium. And we've no difficulty with that. That's their business. They're resident in the capital, and Croke Park Stadium lying idle in the capital. There would be a lot of people who would think that the funds that's raised from that assists.
Just for argument's sake, Dublin are playing Kerry and the game's moved to Thurles. What's wrong with that?
Oh, I have no difficulty with that, but others did have a difficulty with that.
But it's a neutral venue.
There is definitely a lot of money needed to make the GA go round, and it obviously came down to that.
What's
looking at the gates that they can make out of Dublin playing in Croke Park rather than playing somewhere else. But there would be no difficulty in moving. We'll just say that it was a Dublin versus Galway or Mayo game from the Connacht side of things. That could go to Thurles. A game against Kerry could go to Thurles. A game against any of the northern teams could go anywhere along the line. I mean, there are games that only generate 25,000-30,000, so there's plenty of those stadiums around. What they're saying is that the major counties meeting at that stage of the competition would probably draw 50,000 to 60,000, and there's not many of those stadiums around. So we would have no difficulty in the case. If both counties agreed to play a quarter-final in Croke Park, then so be it. But, you know, to say that they have the right to declare it as a home venue and also then deem it as a neutral venue, it's not very fair. There's an unfairness in that situation. And that's all we were highlighting. We tried to put it across as best we could. We didn't use any choice language. We didn't do any name-calling or anything else. We presented it as we were asked to by our members in Donegal. We have 25,000 members. And we were representing those, and it wasn't individual, it wasn't divisive, nor was it negative. And we have the right to go there. We have the democratic right to go there as our rural state. And we went there and represented it. And we accept democracy. Mick, it got beaten.
Mick, can I ask you about your process to get the wording to Congress? Like, what is the formula for that? Like, is there any way that you can road test what's most likely to succeed? For example, I guess what I'm saying, there's a possibility that the wording could have been no team can play two games in Croke Park in the Super 8s. You know, it felt a little bit like this. The wording of this motion is just a little bit easy for people to jump on and pick because... I don't know. I wondered, was there another way of going about this to try and shore up support? Or did you feel like you... Because it makes the perfect sense. This competition now just doesn't have the credibility that it should have if one team is getting an unfair advantage by playing two home matches. It makes no sense. It's just not a fair competition anymore. Was there any other way you could have gone about this, do you think, in retrospect?
Well, it's very easy to be wise after the event. We were being genuine what we were trying to do. I think it's quite clear what we were trying to do to move words around or to reword it or structure it differently, I suppose, is being wise after the event. We didn't take any legal advice or anything like that on it or get some barrister to word it for us in such a way that it would be a lot more watertight. We didn't go down that road because we were being genuine where we're coming from. It was the GA people of Donegal. We were representing. It was the way it was worded. Was worded by them, without going through the loops of getting rewording or whatever done with it.
Would you do anything different if somebody came along next year and tried to get this through? Or what advice would you have to another county who might finally?
I mean, when you get an answer like we got on Saturday, where we were, I think we explained it quite genuinely, where people would know clearly what we were trying to do. And the members in Congress on Saturday were left with no different way of interpreting it. The way they accepted it was that by moving Dublin out of Croke Park or any county that would get into that stage was going to be a loss of revenue to the association. That was the main concern, I think. It wasn't that people were drumming up to back Dublin or to vote against Donegal. The way they viewed it, really, a lot of people... was that by taking such a game of that standard out of Croke Park, then there was going to be a loss of revenue. And the loss of revenue to the association in general is a loss of revenue to everybody that was voting, I suppose. That's my only view of why it went the way it went.
That's slightly alarming, Ger, isn't it? Like, that's in terms of the ethos of the organisation. Like, it came down to revenue in the sense of... And as well as that, you remember last year, these Super 8 games were not particularly memorable at all in Dublin. And what I noticed was people were actually sort of reluctant to travel to Dublin because it didn't really appeal to them to go to Croke Park to watch Dublin play against a team that they were inevitably going to beat. And we've seen this with Dublin. Dublin look vulnerable when they're taken out of Croke Park. And they only beat Tyrone narrowly enough in home at 4 points. They lost two league games this year away from home. And football and Dublin fans love to travel. But ultimately, according to what we're hearing there, this was entirely based on money. Money, money, money. And that's worrying.
Yeah, Mick, it is. It does seem as if, in terms of a debate like this, it would be good if everybody had all the information, like how much revenue would be lost in this one instance, for example, if Dublin weren't able to nominate Croke Park as their home venue. Was that teased out, or was it just like an, you know...
No, I don't. I think people were nervous to tease that part of it out, and... And look, money does make the world go round, and we're not saying that it doesn't. and every county that is doing any type of structured infrastructure development or improvement or refurbishment or whatever within their grounds do come within their rights to look for assistance and all that. And indeed, we're currently doing that ourselves, as is many counties around the country. But we weren't talking about money. We weren't talking about Dublin. We weren't talking about anybody. And there was a heavy hit against it, without a doubt. We were talking about an unfairness that's in the current rule. And we were not at any stage trying to get away from that point. That it's still there this morning, that unfairness. And, you know, people saying the only place to beat the Dubs is in Croke Park and the only place you'd want to play the Dubs is in Croke Park. That's all fine, beating that drum. And it got success on Saturday. The main reason, and we never at any stage went away from the main reason we brought this motion to Congress, was that there's an unfairness in the current rule. And we, at no stage, got it moved. Now, we had a third of the delegates, 36% of the delegates present, voted that there was, they agreed with us that there was an unfairness there. So that should be a concern to the association, that a third of its members at Congress actually voted in agreement that there is an unfairness there. But there were two-thirds decided to vote that they didn't see any problem with it. Now, there were probably several different reasons, and I don't know them all, why they would have done that. But there would have been, I think the main feeling was move that game out of Croke Park was going to be a concern to the association, would it be a loss of revenue to the association. And I think that's the two main concerns I got. I'm being as factual as I can in my reading of the situation. And if some other people want to say differently, grand, they had the opportunity of saying that.
Yeah.
We brought it to Congress on Saturday. We didn't speak in the media too much about it beforehand. There's been quite a lot of interest in it since. We will be packing it up as from today forward.
Fair enough.
We don't see any more sense in discussing it any further. You've asked me to come on the show this morning, and I have no problem doing that.
And look, I understand why you want to park it as well. But while we have you then, and this is obviously the only conversation we're ever going to have about it, is it something that you could see coming back next year? I don't even know if you're allowed to. Isn't there
I have no difficulty with the democracy of what you're allowed to bring to Congress. There is, if Donegal feel like bringing it back next year again, that they have that within their rights to do that. But I don't know if they would feel like doing it again. If it was a very close vote, you might consider doing it. But because of the answer that was received in the voting system on Saturday, you know, I haven't discussed it with our own members yet, but I wouldn't think that it would be a wise move to make. It was well aired and well trashed, and there was a lot of big hitters spoke against it in a planned way on Saturday, and it was obvious that it wouldn't get support in the future if you brought it up. But I mean, we at no stage attacked Dublin, you know, or were out to get Dublin. But you like to play the best teams in the country. And over the last 7 or 8 years, Dublin have been one of those best teams, and they're worthy All-Ireland champions. They're the team to beat. We don't care where we play them, in Croke Park or in our home venue. But others seemingly have concerns, and we accept that. We accept the majority, and we're Democrats. We'll accept democracy.
Mick, we're going to get Sean Kelly on the line at some stage this week, maybe later on this morning. If you had a couple of questions you could put to him, having seen his contribution from the floor at Congress on Saturday, what would you like to ask him now?
I think his choice of language was unwelcome. In an All-Ireland forum, where a county who, quite within their rights, and quite within the rights of Congress, and quite within the rights of the people that they represented to go to Congress, asked through a motion for a consideration or an unfairness in an existing rule. And to stand up in his position as a former son of the association and to say that it was negative, was accusing the people of Donegal of being negative. Because that's who we were representing. And we take our GAA sport very, very serious in Donegal. And, you know, we also look at the fact that when we have a game in Dublin, and some people sometimes forget this, that some of our Donegal supporters have up to 200 miles to travel and 200 miles back. And everybody will know, to stay in Dublin overnight cost you anything up to €300 a room. And, you know, it's not fair to ask anybody to travel unfairly. We have the greatest delight in playing Dublin at any other time in any other parts of competitions throughout the system. We found an unfairness in this. It was voiced to us by our delegates. We formed a motion. We did everything correctly, none of it negatively. So for somebody in his position to say to use that type of language, we felt fairly stingy about it, and we still do. And we'll leave it with him whether he wants to retract that particular word. I have no difficulty in anybody debating anything or difficulty in what was said from John Costello. John Costello has the highest regard from the people of Donegal and from the GA officers. And he was defending his corner, and I have no difficulty with that.
But just on that, Mick, just reading the report of it this morning, he said Parnell Park, John Costello said, would be Dublin's nominated alternative. I might be missing something there. What does Parnell Park have to do with this?
It had absolutely nothing at all to do with it. We never mentioned Dublin in the motion. What we were saying was that no team could play two of the three games in the one venue. And in Croke Park, because you won't get, it's a disadvantage, and there's nobody in the country would tell you that it's not a disadvantage. Now, Dublin playing two of the three games in Croke Park, no other county was getting two games in Croke Park. So, the voices have voiced and they've spoken, and yeah. We will live with it.
Yeah.
And we're, as I said at the very outset, Jared, we're big boys. We can take it on the chin. We can take. Getting defeated, we can take winning, but provided there's a level playing field. We were voicing that there was an unlevel playing field. The majority didn't accept that, and we will live with that.
Yeah, it's just that you're right. That's the thing. That's the annoying thing here, is that you are right, that last year it was clear there was an anomaly in the system. There was an opportunity for the GAA in the off-season to fix it. That opportunity was Congress at the weekend, and they said, no, we need the money more than we need the opportunity to run a fair competition.
Well, it was also voiced that at that time of the year, Dublin would have quite a home base of supporters, and that there's no other ground would take that particular match. The Super 8 was very much supported by our own county when it came in front of Congress, quite simply because to bring that standard of match, quarterfinals of the All-Ireland, out into the rural pitches and the rural towns of Ireland was much required in an association that has to be very wary of where it's going in the future. And we were very supportive of that. Places, and I don't have to name drop half a dozen towns around Ireland who require that type of game to boost their economy, to boost their chances, to put fairness and equality into the competition, and more importantly, to put the association in a higher standard with its supporters, is very much wanted. And I think games in Killarney and Castlebar and Ballybuffet and towns like that around the country put a huge buzz of excitement into the competition. And the games that took place in Omagh last year, when Dublin travelled to Omagh, when Tyrone came to Ballybuffet away from home for Tyrone, they won that game. We were delighted to have been part of that. It was a very high-pitched game in front of 18,000 people. And it was the buzz that was in the game and it was the atmosphere that was in the game that made it special. Nothing at all to do with any of the other reasons that were pre-discussed. And that's what we were looking at on the Super 8s, and I think a lot of counties voted for the Super 8s and that. But obviously, it has now taken a different turn on it, and other reasons can be used. And I'm not here rebel rousing against anything. I accept democracy. We do not accept the unbalance that's in the rule, but we went with the motion, and it has been defeated. We'll accept that.
One last thing, Mick. There was a general consensus forming on social media from GAA people, it has to be said, that there's a disconnect now between what happened to Congress and the rank and file members of the GAA, and that this is the vote which signifies that more than anything, because everybody who believes in fairness believes competition should be fair. Two home games out of three for one team, particularly the best team, does not result in a fair competition. Do you agree that there's a disconnect between the powers that be in the GAA and the rank and file membership?
No, I wouldn't be party to agree to that. I think that we have a very, very democratic system, that if somebody in the smallest club in Ireland wishes to put something forward for Congress, it can actually get on the floor. And when you have that type of democracy, I think that we have a fairly good democracy. We've got big hitters at Congress. We've got very good speakers. We've got stronger counties than other counties. And we've got more powerful financial-backed counties than other counties. We've got better footballing and hurling counties than others. You know, there are strong and there's weak and there's middling. and there's those that are striving to connect and make their dreams come true. But what we must at all stages retain is a level playing field in all our rooms for all of the members. And is there a requirement for two-tier and three-tier competitions? There is. That has worked in hurling. I was in Croke Park last year when our own hurlers won the Nicky record. That was a big All-Ireland for them. So you've got to take that moment and believe that what they knew, they'd reached their goal in winning that, as much as Limerick had in winning the All-Ireland Hurling Senior Championship. And, you know, so for football, it's the same. And some, let's be honest, some counties in the next 20 years might not even get playing in Croke Park if you don't structure it in such a way and give them the opportunity to do that. In hurling, they have it working at the moment. In football, I think it will come. But for the member that right down in the smallest junior club in Ireland, he has the opportunity through the system at the moment of getting anything on the clar at Congress. And I think there are people, through a lot of it through social media, that beat the GAA as well. But I think there is quite a lot of the technical things in and around rules are dealt with by committees within Croke Park, and they bring that to Congress, and it's voted on. And I think there's a lot of people then on the outside say that's all happened internally and it's not getting discussed pre-Congress. But to be fair, all of the motions that were on the clar at Congress were sent to our county in advance of Congress. We sent them out to all our clubs, but maybe many of our clubs did not discuss them. That's their failure, not the failure of the GAA. We had an opportunity of bringing them back to our county executive, and we discussed what we were going. We had a clear mandate in what we were doing. So that system is okay, and I think it's only right that I would be fair with that.
All right. Mick, you've been very good with your time this morning. Thanks very much for joining us here on OTB AM.
Okay, John, thank you.
It's Mick McGrath, the Donegal County Chairman, obviously very disappointed at the fact that what seems like, on the face of it, a very straightforward tweak to the rules to make the competition, the biggest Gaelic football competition in the country, fair, failed.
What's annoying for him is that there's an awful lot of spin on what they were actually looking for here, just looking at the reports this morning. That basically is what he couldn't have articulated better what Donegal were looking for, which was literally fairness. But there was a lot of spin against it. And I'm also wondering, the votes here, would these have been would there have been hurling representatives who would have voted on this with no interest whatsoever in football, but basically voted in thinking that, well, it actually would mean more money for the organisation and it might help us, so we're going to vote for it? Because I can't see how anyone other than Dublin would vote for this, really. And if it came down to money, you have to question, is it an amateur organisation, or is it just another, like, you know, basically nod to capitalism here?
Well, that's a good question. Sean Kelly, former president of the GAA, has spoken against this motion at Congress on Saturday. Sean, you're very welcome. I do want to put something to you straight off the bat here. Mick McGrath said that he hoped that you would withdraw the word negative to describe the Donegal motion. And I've got to put that to you straight off the bat. Are you willing to withdraw the notion that it was a negative comment?
No, I'm not. I just commented practically on the wording of the motion. It was written in negative sense because it said no county could nominate Croke Park as their home venue. That's a negative. That's what I was talking about. And I think if it was approached in a different light, it might have got a different result. But because it was worded like that, and particularly, I think, as the Meath County representative said that because of the way it was worded, that if they were developing Park Talton and they wanted to nominate Croke Park as their home venue for some match, they couldn't do so either. So from that point of view, it was negatively the way it was worded. If it was worded in a different light, it might have got a different result, but it was beaten 2-1.
Yeah, is that not a little bit semantic, Sean, is that not a bit of a fig leaf for the people who voted against this, when ultimately what this means is that next year the competition will not be a fair competition? Dublin will have two home games in the Super 8, which gives them an unfair advantage against everybody else.
Yeah, but I suppose Croke Park has to be located in some county. It is located in Dublin, thankfully. Dublin can attract big numbers to the matches, and the games are played there. But I think if it was worded differently, of which would make a big difference, would be, for instance, if they said that Dublin could play their home game in Croke Park, but the final game would be played in a neutral venue, then that would change the situation completely. Or, as I said, maybe we should look at playing one game at home, one game away, and toss for the final one. And then if they were to meet again subsequently in other years, that the team that was away would be at home the next time. I think all those are issues that would deal with what Donegal want to do in a fairer or more transparent way and without any negativity which would be seen that way in Dublin. And indeed, regarding negativity, the response from John Costello showed the depth of feeling there was in Dublin about the way the motion was worded again. No disrespect to Donegal, but just that I think a different approach, we might have got a different result.
But ultimately, Sean, who cares about the wording? We want a fair championship here. It really doesn't matter how it was worded, as long as you can get a neutral venue. And as well as that, obviously you mentioned Croke Park, and it's great that people come to Dublin. It'd be a lot better if people could come to places like Thurles or places down the country that actually could do with tourism a lot more than Dublin needs it.
Yeah, of course, but the wording does matter because you're passing a motion on the wording. So you can say the wording doesn't count. The wording is everything in a motion, down to the finest detail. And I agree completely with you. It's great to have games down the country. And that's why I suggested that if all the games were played at neutral venues, or not neutral venues, home and away, or if the final game was played in a neutral venue, with Croke Park being the home venue for Dublin, that would sort the issue and to be much more positive and helpful to everybody. And then you could have your final game in Thurles or Portlaoise or Cork or wherever you want to.
Sean, this looks like sleight of hand from everybody involved in the GAA, that like immediately after the only motion to fix the massive imbalance in last year's championship is defeated, everybody's full of good ideas about what the wording should have been. Why was another wording not put forward? If you have a better wording, why didn't you put that forward 3 months ago whenever this was first mooted?
Well, I'm not involved in the Kerry County Board. The Kerry County Board actually were supportive of Dublin in this endeavour against the motion. So it wasn't for me to be putting forward a motion like that. But having seen the motion, had the debate, seen what it was about, I am now making a suggestion of how it could be rectified. And actually, I'd be very surprised if there isn't a motion similar to what I'm suggesting now doesn't come from some unit of the association next year, because I think it makes eminent sense to deal exactly with what you're saying, to establish parity, and shouldn't be seen as anti-Dublin or anti-anyone, and shouldn't eliminate the possibility of any county playing in Croke Park if they so wished, as the Mead secretary said, if their ground wasn't available. The same could apply to Kildare or anyone else. The wording of the motion, which was put to Congress last Saturday, would prohibit all those situations. And in fact, that is not what it was intended to do, but it would do so. Because
and in the meantime, said, this year's championship, Sean, will be unfair. Dublin will get two home games in the Super 8s and more than likely coast through to a semi-final untouched.
Well, Dublin are a great team at the minute, and it's going to take a great team to beat them, whether it's in Croke Park or elsewhere.
Yeah, but the competition's unfair. It's an unfair competition because one of the teams has two home games.
You can say it's unfair, but it went through Congress. The motion wasn't accepted. So is that unfair? That's another way of looking at it. I think it was a good idea, but not thought out well enough to get the majority of delegates.
Why did nobody help Donegal to craft a motion? That's the thing here. Somebody should have helped Donegal to craft a motion that gets through this year so that we don't have another year of unfairness. The whole point about Meath, for example, then Meath could have come back next year, voted for it this year and said, by the way, that's great, we're not developing Park Talchin this year, so that's grand, but what if we were? Let's fix that for next year and change the wording. This, like, let's keep everybody at arm's length, let's not try and be progressive and fix the wrongs, let's just make sure that nothing happens and we're stuck with stasis. That's what happened at the weekend.
No, that's not true. Delegates have to go to Congress, look at what's in front of them, vote on it according to the wording and its merits, and you can't be saying we can do it now and accept something this year and then change it again next year. That's not the way it works. They have to deal with each motion as it comes. They looked at it, and as I said, while the intention was good, the solution wasn't the best, in my opinion, and the opinion of two-thirds of Congress. But
so you're voting for a championship that is not that is not fair. That's what you voted for. You voted to maintain the status quo, which is an unfair championship. And I think it's going to leave an asterisk in years to come beside Dublin when they win these two championships. And everybody's like, oh yeah, that was the year they had the two home games and it was supposed to be fair.
I think that's overstating it now. I mean, any team that wins four in a row And to say that because they had one extra game in Croke Park was the reason they won, I think most people wouldn't agree with that. I think most people would say that Dublin have done fantastically well. They're a great team.
And it's great that they're getting help from Croke Park to win
to beat them.
And from Congress. Sean, unfortunately, we know you've got to go. You've been good with your time. Thanks a million.
No problem, you're welcome. Thanks very much.
Sean Kelly, former president of the
It's a Monday morning. Didn't really expect to be talking about this, but Kerry, I love Kerry County Board to just come on at some stage this week and tell us why they voted against this motion.
But look, when the wording came out, we sat here with Owen and went through it and went, this isn't going to pass. People aren't going to, they're going to say that there was a much better way to word this and it was about the, and sure, low as nightfall as day, it was like, ooh, there's a little, we can wriggle off this.
Yeah, but I just don't get the thing about the wording. That's like looking for an excuse. And it looks like they voted for this purely on financial lines. Like, how can Kerry explain to me? It wasn't a mean-spirited proposal. Donegal are just basically saying Dublin shouldn't play a neutral game at their home venue. So can Galway play their neutral game at Pier Stadium this year? No, they can't. So the Donegal thing was not mean-spirited at all from what I can see. Obviously, Donegal are looking out for a motion that would make it a bit fairer and would help Donegal. That's fair enough. Democracy works. But can Kerry explain to me why they voted against a motion that would mean Kerry could be playing Dublin in Croke Park as the neutral game for Dublin this year? Like, Dublin have a massive advantage of playing in Croke Park. They've lost two games in the league out of Croke Park this year. Once they come back to Croke Park, I think teams really, really struggle to beat them. That's manifestly true. And it doesn't actually help the championship. The games in Croke Park were very, very... If you remember anything from the football championship last year, it was the games that were played out of Croke Park. Now, the games at Croke Park were largely forgettable.
Oh, the Super 8s, the first games, the neutral, using them at the start as they were damp squibs. The ultimate, like, oh, this is going to be great. Everybody gets to play in Croke Park. And then it's like, well, no one shows up. The stadium's too big games unless there's like 50,000 at it. And they didn't have 50,000 at it. And the opportunity to have games all around the country was blown.
And is the GA looking after, you know, is the GA looking after the Gaelic Athletic Association members or towns around the country that genuinely could do with a little help from the massive tourism boost that a game like this does? Dublin doesn't need it at all. So are they looking at that, or are they just literally looking at this and saying, we need the money?
And I'd like to see how much money there is. I'd like to see what the absolute written down number is. If we get 40,000 at this game, it's an extra 400 grand, which divided between the 32 counties or the, I don't know how much goes to the London County Board and how much goes to North America or if anything.
What, like, was their neutral game last year? Was it Roscommon? Was it Donegal they played in Croke Park as well, wasn't it?
They played Donegal. So Donegal's neutral game.
Was it Donegal or was it the Roscommon game?
Well, I can't remember.
In any event, I'd how many Roscommon fans, that was an absolute dead rubber. For that game, for example, how many Roscommon fans travelled and how much did the organisation actually make from that game?
Who saw a minute of it, really? Because the game was on TV.
I don't even remember. I remember nothing of it. I didn't watch any of it.
Paul Flynn scored an amazing goal.
If Dublin came to Roscommon, on the other hand, or if you had your neutral game in Páirc Uí Chaoimh, for example, if they were playing Kerry, or if they were playing Kerry, you could play it in Thurles. Massive for the town, massive for Thurles. Does Croke Park need it?
Well, the Donegal game could have been in Clonus. It would have been sensational. Mm. And the Dubs fans love it and the Dublin players love it. And
absolutely, like, absolutely. I'm baffled by the wording being so relevant or being made. I have a lot of respect for Sean Kelly. I don't really see why the wording mattered at all in this.
So 53,000 were at the Mona and Kildare, Dublin, Donegal, double bill. And 33,000 were at the Roscommon match.
So the 33,000, like, I don't know the figures, but that's not making much money, if at all, for Croke Park, I would have thought. 32,000 for the cost of having a game there, catering for 82,000 people.
The Roscommon game was a doubleheader, was it?
Can't quite remember. But those games undermine football. Football isn't in a position where it can be anyway kind of frivolous about things like this, because football is really struggling in terms of the hearts and minds of an awful lot of people. And Dublin's dominance is a large part of that. The mass defence...
The integrity of the competition does not stand.
Absolutely.
You've got a situation where you're giving a massive advantage to one team that already has the biggest population and all the other stuff that, like, we haven't even touched on in terms of funding. And you've decided that you had an opportunity to change it. And instead of correcting the wording months ago, they were like, well, it's going to give us another year of this, lad. Let's see what happens, you know. And then But in the meantime, the integrity of this year's competition does not stand.
Imagine having 30 league games and playing 20 of them at home.
It'd be great, wouldn't it? It'd be amazing.
Especially when you're Dublin.
You'd be delighted.
I've massive respect for the Dublin team. I think they're brilliant ambassadors for the sport. And I think they're probably the greatest football team we've ever seen. Blah, 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 blah. They shouldn't be playing two of their home games at Croke Park.
Kildare and Mayo under-20s played before the Dublin Roscommon game. So it wasn't really a doubleheader by any... proper metrics.
I would love to know why Kerry voted against it, for example. Kerry are a county that would intrinsically, right at the centre of this, could be benefiting from this not being in place, yet they voted for it. I'm gobsmacked. I don't know. Maybe there's a good reason for it.
The wording was wrong, Johnny.
Yeah, it's all about the wording.
Very quickly, the Dublin Derby tonight, you're heading along?
Yeah, really looking forward to it.
Across the city to Bowles.
You know the way that the conventional winger is gone now? Like, the wingers don't really exist anymore in football. Everything's gone through the middle. So Shamrock Rovers basically have about 17 central midfielders in their team at the moment. And Stephen Bradley has this system where it's really, really front-loaded with number 10s. And I've massive respect for the Bowles management team of Crawley and Long, and I think they're really going to try to counteract that tonight. It's going to be rocking in Dalymount Park because it's actually top of the table class. They're both unbeaten as well.
Going to see any of these goals? The embargo, which didn't exist, is over. Sorry with this.
Well, you can't show goals until Soccer Republic show them. So the first division, there were some great goals on Friday night. The first division clubs can do whatever they want online, but the Premier Division clubs, as far as I know, they can't. And as Daniel McDonald pointed out here on Saturday, so the first chance you have to watch your goals on Friday night is actually at 7:30 tonight when you're not even watching because you're at a game.
Yeah. All right.
So it doesn't make much sense. But if the game's sold out, but there are a lot of other good games tonight, and it's just a shame a lot more people can't watch it.
Coming up on Off the Ball, Monday Night Rugby, looking back at the Italy game, obviously, and some more analysis and opinion coming off the back of what Ronan O'Gara and Alan Quinlan were saying on our show this morning. Obviously, of course, in the football show tonight, reaction to all the weekend's football. And no doubt that GAA story is going to run and run as well. But that's our lot. Slightly extended show for you this Monday morning. Thanks very much. We'll see you tomorrow morning. Good luck. So, if you like this, you'll probably also like OTB AM, Ireland's only sports breakfast show. Subscribe to the OTB AM podcast stream or catch the show live on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook or offtheball.com every morning from 7:45 AM.